Good evening, everyone. This week is Parshas Vayera. And Parshas Vayera, there's a reminder on page 26, Dr. Gimel on the base. This maimer begins with Pasach Elio. This Hasidic discourse from the Alter Rebbe. This Hasidic discourse from the Alter Rebbe is really a classic. This is one of those memorim that everybody ought to learn. Every person who wants to have some understanding in Hasidic concepts and Kabbalistic. Any serious student of Kabbalah or Hasidus, this maimer clarifies many, many basic concepts in a very incredible manner. It's a different style a little bit than the other maimer. First of all, it's not really going to deal with anything much in the parsha. All the way in the end, is going to connect it to a verse this week in the parsha, having to do with Hashem descending to see what's happening in Sodom. And that's all that it is. It's not, and there's no main, doesn't really clarify or get into some explanation of usually the Maimonides give us the spiritual insight in the content of something in the parsha. This Maimer doesn't deal with that at all. Also, it's different than another Maimonides is that it's not so much an emotional Maimer, or we can call it an inspirational Maimer. This maimer is not so much of an inspirational maimer as it is enlightening. It really enlightens and clarifies. So any later when you study Hasidus and you come across various terms and you constantly learn about, particularly the concept of the Esh Sphiros, of the ten attributes of Hashem, in order to understand them and appreciate what they are, and this is this maimer. It also really will wrap up a lot of ideas that we spoke about in the previous weeks, the last 2 weeks. Give us great insight in them. So this is... Yeah, it's the Torah Or. So let's begin. There is a passage in Zohar. I think it's in the Hagdama, in the introduction to Zohar. I think that's where it comes from. Pasach Elio. I think it's in the introduction to Zohar. There's a few introductions. So one of the things with the introduction on the preface of Zohar, there is a statement which is attributed to Eliyahu HaNavi. We say it. Many people say it every morning. A lot of people say Pasach Elio every morning, and some people say it. The Chabad custom is to say it on Friday night, Friday evening before Mincha. We say Pasach Elio. So Pasach Elio is referring. It's a teaching, a mystical teaching by Elio Anavi, and he describes basically the elements of the concepts of the Esh Sefirot, of the ten attributes, which are attributed to God. And many of the fundamental ideas that we know about the Esh Sefirot all derive from this Pasach Elio. So I'm just going to read a little bit in English over here from the Siddur of Pasach Elio so that we know what we're talking about, and then we'll learn the mind. So it says like this, Pasach Elio v'ama. Elio opened his discourse and he said, Ribayin olmen da'antu chad, Master of the world, you are one. V'loy b'chushban, but not in the numerical sense. You're one, but you're not one in a numerical sense. Amtu ilah akol ilay. You are exalted above all exalted ones. Stima akol sedimin. Hidden from all the hidden ones. Leif machshav etzisabach klal. There is no thought that can grasp you at all. Referring to Hashem, saying that God, you are completely one, but a oneness that is not, can't be counted. It's not within the realm of counting, as we can say one, which followed by two, but your oneness is completely detached, the simple one, the one that is higher than any numbers. And you're beyond, you're concealed, there's no thought that can grasp you. But then he continues, Amtu dapikas asar tikkunim. You are the one who has brought forth ten, he translates it as garments. We're going to see more that tikkunim means more ornaments. You have brought about 10 ornaments, which are garment-like, 10 garments. V'karimim lo'in asar sfirim. And we refer to them as the 10 attributes. And why did you bring about these 10 attributes? What was the point of these 10 attributes? V'anhagabah in omen, to direct with them worlds. Almond steaming, concealed worlds, the lawyer's galleon that isn't revealed. The almond is galleon, and then furthermore, and to direct with them the revealed worlds, and with these garments you also hide and conceal yourself from people. The amtu, the kasha loin, and you bind them, and the yachid loin, and unify them. Right, that's, then he continues on and on. But the main point is that it says, of God, you in essence are one, beyond everything. Nevertheless, you issued forth from yourself 10 sephiros, 10 attributes, 10 ornaments, or 10 garments. And we refer to them as esospheres. And what's the purpose of these esospheres? So that you can have a relationship with the world. It's through them that you direct the creation. The higher creations, the lower creations, but you direct the creations through the esospheres. And then later he says, that's already a couple of verses later, he continues, levushin tekinas loim, minayu parcha nishmasin l'bnei nishah. You have made garments for them. That means, for the Efes Spheros, which themselves are considered ornaments, the kunin, or, no, we have the Efes Spheros, which he called before ornaments, in a sense we refer to them already as garments. So those garments, you created further garments. You created garments for the garments, or garments for the ornaments. The esospheres themselves are enveloped in other and further more external garments. The menayu parcha nishmasim l'bnei nishah. From them issue forth souls to people. The souls come forth from where? Not directly from the 10 attributes, from the ornaments, but rather from the garments that are for the ornaments. The kama gufin tkinas loim. And many bodies you have made for them. Which these body figures, whatever they are, they're called bodies in comparison to the garments. Seemingly, as we're going to learn, what he's saying is like this, that even though we said before that the Esos Sephiros are what? Are considered external to God, because they're considered ornaments that he issues forth and not him. And then, right? But then, being that later, after that, following that, God brings forth Hashem, God brings forth levushin, he brings forth garments, we're going to see what they are. So in comparison to those garments that are extremely external to God, the sephiros themselves are called bodies, they're called a body. It's almost like his body, a body for him. So what he seems to be saying is that there is God himself, as he transcends any form. Then Hashem issues forth Esos Sephiros, and the Esos Sephiros are ornaments, they're like external, they're garments, but they're only garments in what? In relationship to higher. To God himself, they're considered external. But in as much as the lower, anything lower than that is concerned, they're considered the body of God himself. Of course, anthropomorphically speaking, that this is only means the body is only for in compared, you know, as I'm using as a mashal, but trying to associate that the spheres are far more merged and unified with him than what? Than the outer garments. And there, that's why they're called levushin. But the spheres are called gufin. They're called God kiryachal, meaning to say, by way of a mashal, of course, they're called what? God's body, if anything to say. And that's why it continues. For example, he says the emotional attributes, chesed roya yamina, chesed, kindness, is considered God's right arm. Gevura roya smala, and the gevura is called the left arm, so it's like the body of him. Teferes gufa, teferes like the torso, netzach v'hoid, netzach and hoid, rein shoykim, those are the two thighs or feet, Misoit, Yomadigufa, Yiskoi, Malchus Pat, so whatever. He goes through the various different parts of the series that they call the body of Hashem. So we need to talk about that. And then later in the Maimer, later in this discourse, he goes on and he says these words. Amtu Chakim, you are, let me find it. Oh, so quite a bit later. He says, Amtu Chakim v'loy v'chachma yediya, you are wise but not with a knowable attribute of wisdom. Amtu Maven v'loy divina yediya, you understand but not with a knowable attribute of understanding. In Leifa Chasar Yediya, you don't have any specific place. So to gain clarity in everything we've learned over here, which really you understand that this Pasuk HaLayo lays a little, the cornerstone and the foundation for any understanding of any Kabbalistic understanding and appreciation of the divine attributes and so on and so forth. These are the fundamentals. So this mimer is going to discuss, the mimer that we're learning tonight, this idea. Mainly the Alter Rebbe is going to juggle one part. This idea of what these Esser Spheres are. Are they God himself, or they're not him? You see in Pasuk HaLayo, he dances back and forth. He begins that they're what? They're not him. Because God is one, and not with a numerical oneness. Totally beyond. But then, from him stem the Esser Spheres. The Esser Spheres emerge from him. But then on the other hand, he says they're considered his body. And then there are garments that are considered far more external. So is it him or is it not him? What's God's relationship with the spheres? That's the court of the mind. So let's read inside. Pasach Eliyahu and Navi. Eliyahu Elijah the prophet, who gave this teaching. How it got to, I guess, Shimon Bar Yochai recorded it. Maybe it was something that he taught him. And Eliyahu Navi came to him and gave him this teaching, which laid the foundation for Zohar and things like that.
This originated
from the book. I guess Eliyahu Navi knows it from somewhere. Yeah, I guess he must have had some prophecy in it. Yes.
So, do you know
what you're saying? Spheres and Hashem. That's what he's going to discuss. Yeah, so that's what he's going to explore. What does it mean? And the difference between that and the other parts that are called Levushin and so on. Let's read. Pasach Eliyahu opened up. And he said, he began his discourse, and he said, Antu Chad, you are one, Eloi B'chujban, but not with the numeric oneness. Antu Da Pikas Eser Tikkunin. You have brought forth Eser Tikkunin, 10 ornaments, or 10 garments. Lahavin in Yinzeh, understand this matter. Lama Nikri Yutzvidis B'Shem Tikkunin. Why are the 10 attributes called Tikkunin? Tikkunin garments or ornaments. Now we're going to say it like this. Later in the Pasuk Eliyahu, he also speaks about a level called garments. That you created also Levushin Kinaslahan. You created garments. But over there he calls it garments. Over here he refers to them as tikkunim. Tikkunim means an ornament, like jewelry. And he refers to the Esser Spheres as Esser Tikkunim. Tikkunim are not ordinary garments, which means within garments themselves, which a person dresses, you enclose yourself in garments, there are two levels of garments. There are garments that are called ordinary clothing, and then there are garments that are like jewelry. And he's going to explain the difference between jewelry and garments. Because a person becomes deeply united, unify the jewelry that they wear in a much deeper way than they become with their clothing. And that's the difference that he's going to explain between God's relationship with the spheres, with the attributes, in the world of Atzilus, in the world of the first, in the world of emanation, where the spheres, the first place where the spheres appear, and at least in a full-fledged appearance, the Esher Spheres, and as those spheres already extend themselves into lower realms of existence in the lower worlds, where over there they become more external to God, or they become more like creations as opposed to part of the divine reality. So let's see what he says. So tzadach lahagdim, in order to understand this, we need to preface, be it inyan mahusa nefesh, we need to understand what is the essence of the soul, the content, the essence of the soul. Because we know that God created the human being to be in the image of Him. Because Hashem wanted us to know Him, so He created us by knowing ourselves, by exploring the inner structure of our psychological makeup. So by understanding ourselves, we gain insight and understanding in the divine reality. As it says, "Nitzari echzel lekai." From my flesh, I see God. So by examining and by investigating and researching the human psyche, we get some insight. Of course, we have to realize that whatever religion, whatever all these things as they appear in us are in completely in a tiny, minute a way that we can't. In God, all these things are infinitely greater and infinitely more sublime and abstract than they are in us. But nevertheless, we get some idea of how the things work. So we understand the soul. So we find something interesting. When you look at a human being, so you want to get to know, like, who is this person? So the first thing that you notice are the more external parts of you. You see their body, of course. And if you want to get to know more their personality, so you look. Say, do I know a person? How do you know a person? So by observing, let's say, their behavior, you see their activities. You see the content of their conversations, their behavior, their thoughts, speech, and action. Now, thoughts you can't really see, but at least speech and actions, that's expressive of a person. So you get to know. I know you. I know you because I saw your behavior. I've seen, I've heard you speak. I heard you, in conversation. So I know this person. So in a sense, you get to know someone because most people don't really hide that much in their activities, but that's not necessarily, because a person can sometimes act in a way that covers up on their true entity. Sometimes people act very tough, and if you look at them and you see them in their business and places, they seem to be extremely tough and rigid people. But then you say, you know, you don't know this person. He's the nicest human being. It's just an act that they're putting up. So you see that what activity is external. It's not necessary. Sometimes people act in a very pious manner. Really, they're not at all as pious as they appear to be on the outside, because action behavior is not you. Behavior, same as also speech. You can ordinarily, most times, speech conveys a human being, but a person can hide behind their speech. You can be acting, put up an act. So speech doesn't really, no one's going to say that actions and speech are the person. They're not you. There's something that you're affecting outside of you. Something that's a projection usually of the person, but it's not. Now, when it comes to thoughts are already more intimate, and if one can read someone else's thoughts, so then you can say you can't hide from me anymore, because if I'm reading your thoughts, then, so, but I remember when I used to go to a tzaddik, or you come from Kabbalist or some holy person. So you want to hide behind your thoughts, because you know they can read your thoughts, so you can only think holy thoughts. You don't want to catch them thinking anything that's not so holy. So he's saying that even in thoughts, you can dress yourself in thoughts. Thoughts don't even necessarily think. Many times you can think other people's ideas, you can read ideas that are not yours, you can even think and go and play in your mind thoughts that you've heard. You can review a speech that you heard. They're not your thoughts, you don't even necessarily agree with them, but they're still thinking. So thoughts are not either you. Most of the time, thoughts mirror and reflect, because you express usually your feelings and your emotions and your ideas in your thoughts. But thought in it by itself is still not the person. So we have thought, speech, and action. They're considered behavior external to the human being. So by knowing them, I don't necessarily know the person just because I know your thoughts and your actions and your words. But if we look a little deeper, so we would say, you know, to really get to know a person, you have to get to know their personality traits. You have to know their character. And namely, the character of the human being is their intellectual character and their emotional character. That's what makes up the type of person you are. If I want to become familiar with someone, let's say I'm going out on a date and I want to know if this person is for me, if I should marry this human being. So what I want to know is I want to look behind their thoughts. I want to look behind their words. If I can only examine and know who they are in the inside, what is who they are in the inside? Namely, their emotional state. What are their passions? What do they love? What are their likes? What are their dislikes? What are their fears? What do they fight for? What is important to them? And things like that. These things, that's already far more who you are. You are what you feel, but your emotional makeup, your emotional structure, that is really much deeper. That's your inner image, your inner structure. Also intellectually, I want to know your philosophy on life. How do you think? What's your grasp? What's your take on worldly issues, on religious issues, and so on and so forth? You want to know the person's beliefs, the person's convictions, and so on and so forth. So that's the person himself. If I can know your emotions and your intellect, then I know you, because that's you. Thoughts, speech, and action, you might be just putting up an act, because that's external. But emotions, that's you. So the Rebbe says, okay, emotions, but that's not the essence of the human being. Even though the intellect and the emotions comprise the character, the personality of a human being, but that too is not yet the very, very essence of a person. The very, very essence of the soul, the Rebbe says over here, is a simple energy. It's a simple, undefined energy called the human soul that is beyond any character, the intelligence and the emotions which differentiate one human being from the other human being are only external, meaning there are things that are impressed upon the soul. You might even say they're carved out into the person. But what is the human soul at its very essence? The human soul has a level of existence where it exists deeper than any emotions, deeper than any understanding. It's like a plain sheet of paper that exists prior to any images you put on it. That's the Mohusha Nefesh. That's the very essence of the soul. Let's read it inside. So to understand the soul, he says, Kinei HaNefesh Mitzad Atzmo, the soul by itself, the Ur Pashas, is a simple light. It's a simple energy, a simple light. Malias Chalkas, without the subdivisions, the divisions of or the character, Seichel Midas of intellect, of intelligence and emotions. Now, even though what? The Seichel Midas, the emotions and the intelligence are what? Deeply ingrained or engraved in the human being, but nevertheless they still don't capture the essence. They're not the essence. And the intelligence and the emotions, and tchinas levushim lahanefesh, their garments to the soul. What is shahan nefesh? Meaning, just like a garment. What's a garment? A garment isn't you. A garment is a part of you. You place yourself in your garments. You enclose yourself in the garment. You envelop yourself in the garment, and therefore you present yourself to others through your garments. But they're detached. Same is also the intelligence and the emotions of the human being, something that is external to the person. It's only you enclose yourself in them. Shahan nefesh yesh loy seichel l'midos. The nefesh contains or has intelligence, it has emotions. Avol einon mohusa atzmus hanefesh. But they're not the very essence of the soul. So now he presents a question. He says, but in Tanya, umasha kasa b'tanya, we're learning the Haggadah, the parentheses, this that it says in Tanya, that the soul itself is characterized and is divided into two parts, the intelligence and the emotions. And we say, this is considered the very essence of the soul. So he says, this that he says in Tanya, that is called the very essence of the soul, that is only relative to what? To the behavior. Relative to thought, speech, and action, which are really external. So compared to that, we say that the intelligence and the emotions, that's your inner character. That's what makes up your persona. Your personality, inner personality, is structured by your intelligence and your emotions. So relative to that, this is called your essence. But in truth, when you really analyze the soul itself, you realize that even the intelligence and the emotions, they too are but an external aspect of the soul, not its essence. Ein zeh explains, elo l'gabe machshava dibra maase. This is only when we compare it to thought, speech, and action. Shehein, now they're also garments. Now if we're saying that the soul, and if we're saying now, what is the altogether saying? That really the intellect and the emotions are really also only garments. They're not you. They're something that you attach yourself to, but they're not you. So that's the case. So what's the real difference? What is the defining what is the differentiating aspect that separates the inner character from the human being from their behavior? If both of them are garments, so here you're enclosing yourself in intelligence, you're enclosing yourself in emotions, and here you're enclosing yourself in speech and action or in thoughts. General, it's the same idea. You might say, okay, this is like an undershirt and this is like your outer shirt. It's like your head. Fine. But they're all sort of within the same category of what? Of garments. So how can he say in Tanya? No, he calls this the essence and he calls this only garments. So the year that Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, is going to explain clearly and say that it's not just, when we say it's garments, we're speaking about a complete distant idea of garments. Because within garments themselves are two types of garments. And that's why the higher form of garments, which are the intelligence and the emotions, are hardly garments. They're garments, but we can hardly see them as garments. Because they're far more unified with the human being. How does he say? So he says like this. Thought, speech, and action are garments. They're garments that are separated. They're called separated garments. Garments that are detached from the person. And seichel and nidreis, the intelligence and the emotions, are unified garments. Meaning once the soul encloses itself in these garments, this characterizes the soul. The soul becomes characterized by its garments, by these garments, by its intelligence and its emotions. This defines and gives an imprint on the soul itself. And that's why they're called garments that are part and parcel of the human being. Thought, speech, and action are considered garments, but garments that are separated. And to clarify this matter, we're going to speak in a couple of minutes. We're going to explain what that means. But generally, the idea is that two types of garments. There are garments that are completely separated from you, and there are garments that become... A quick example for that is, garments that are separated are regular clothing. Clothing aren't you. You put on your clothing, you take off your clothing. So you can completely separate yourself from your clothing. Whenever you decide, you can take off your hat and put on your hat. Or you can, you know, put on your shirt, take it. You can, these are, they have absolutely no intrinsic bond to the person of the garments. But then there's also a different type of garments. For example, use the body. The body is considered a garment for the soul. The soul isn't a physical entity. It's a spiritual thing that it once existed in a complete spiritual state, detached, utterly detached from a body. But then once the body, the soul was enclosed in the body, they merged together and the soul can't remove itself. For as long as God determined that the neshama should reside in the body, they live in complete unity and unification, that they become completely entwined one with each other. And that's called an attached garment. So similar to that, he explains as follows. Thought, speech, and action are garments that are separate. You can remove them whenever you want. That's why we find a human being is, let's say, involved. You get yourself involved in an activity. Let's say you're building something, or you're writing something, or you're drawing, or you're cleaning, whatever it is that you're painting, whatever a human being is doing, any activity. So you're enclosed. In that moment, while you're doing it, you're invested in it. Not just that you're doing something. You place yourself into it. When you're writing, it's your mind, your heart, your soul, your passion, everything in you, you're enclosed in that activity. And you're not available for anything else because you've placed yourself in an activity. But at any given moment, you can just stop. You decide to stop just by the will of the soul. You just say, I don't want this anymore. So you stop doing it. Which means that you can completely divest yourself from that garment. Same is also a conversation. You can be in the midst of talking and speaking and say, I don't want to talk anymore. Stop. So that means that it's a garment that you can remove, you can take it off. Even thought is something that you can stop. You can stop thinking. You're thinking something to stop. But even though generally we know that, wow, thought is very different. Because in action and in speech, you can halt, you can stop, you can pause completely. You can stop doing, you can stop speaking. When it comes to thought, you can't stop thinking. A person will always have thoughts passing through their mind. You can't be thoughtless, completely beyond any thought. That can't happen.
So it's not an outer garment.
So in a sense, it seems to be an art, it seems to be what? An inner garment, something that's attached to. There's no, because yes, it's true, you always have to think, but the particular thoughts that you're thinking that you can stop. You can decide at any moment, I'm not going to think this, and change your thought to something else. That you can do. And if you can't, sometimes we find that it's hard, and you're thinking something, and you try to stop thinking about it, and you try to divert your attention to think about something else, and the thought just keeps on coming back in. You're bothered by something. So it just keeps on coming, the thought keeps on barraging, keeps on entering into your mind. So that's not because of the thought. That's because of the emotional bond. That's because you're emotionally connected to it. What thing can you stop thinking? If you think of something that's totally disconnected from you, you're walking somewhere, you see something, so you're thinking about it. And then you say, I don't want to think about it. So if you're not connected, if you don't have any interest in that thing, you stop thinking. It's because, when do you think of something, Tom? Because you have an interest in it. What does that mean? That means it's not because that the thought itself is connected to you. It's not the thought. It's the emotion that's connected. The emotion expresses itself in the thought, and that's what drives the thought. So the emotion is already part and parcel of you. Thoughts themselves are words. External things are something like you're doing. You're creating outside of it. So that's why thoughts, you can also divest yourself, remove the thought. And that's why even when you're emotionally connected to something, you can stop the thought and think something else. 2 minutes later, it will creep back into you. But the thought itself can be removed, because thought is not you. However, that's as long as we're speaking. That's what we say. Thought, speech, and action are considered like external garments. When we're speaking about emotions and intellect, these are things that you can't just stop. If you have it, you have it. If you feel in a certain way towards a certain individual, a certain human being, you love a person. And if someone tells you, no, this is an unhealthy relationship. This love is not good. You have to stop. So you can sit and talk, stop. You can't decide to stop. Not that it's impossible. You know, a certain attachment, a certain love can also be worked on. If it's, you know, you can slowly but surely change yourself, but it's a lot of toil and a lot of effort. It's not something that comes easy. You can't stop loving something. Let's talk something very physical. If you love smoking, and you have even if you know it's wrong, and even if you know it's damaging, you'll do damage, so you can stop the act. That you have control of. You can put down and put out the cigarette. But to change the appetite for the cigarette, that you can't. Eventually, if you won't smoke for a very long time, it will get weaker and weaker and weaker, and maybe you will finally reach, 15 years it takes to remove it, to become disconnected. That's the way it is in emotions. So you see that, emotions are deeply engraved within the person. And again, within emotions themselves are things that you're even, are engraved within the human being in a deeper place, and are things that are more external. But nevertheless, an emotion is something that's carved out in your psyche. Let's say, and being that it's carved out, it's not it's a carving. So a carving you can't just change. A garment that you put on, you can take it off whenever you want, but this is carved out within you. Same as also the intellect. If you understand something in some way, so I can come to you, let's say, and I understand differently. So I can present my idea to you. You can think the words that I'm telling you. You can hear those words. That means you can think the thoughts that I am transmitting to you. But you can't, you don't, if it's different, if it's a complete different understanding than the way you understand, then you can't change your understanding just like that. Eventually, by thinking about it a lot, intentionally, again and again and again, so you can realize that a person can say, you know what, I made a mistake, I thought it was this, I understand now it's different. But you can't decide that I want to understand different than I understand. Either you understand, you don't understand. So, in anything, you know, thought, let's take thought as it relates to the intellect. And emotions, the same thing. For example, let's talk about love. If you hate someone, or you have a hatred towards someone, and you know it's wrong, you shouldn't be hating this person. So you can say to yourself, you know what, for 3 minutes in the day, I will think lovingly to this person. I will think loving thoughts. I will think in my mind, I love you, I love this about you, and so on. Now you can do it. You can think, I love this person because so on. But doesn't mean that you will have that feeling in you. Because the emotion won't change. hopefully after a long time, this type of therapy will work, and slowly you will start seeing the good in the person. And could be you will, if you train yourself to see the good in someone, or you can change your attitude towards this person. But the thought you can think, see, even if the thought is, even if it goes contrary to the emotion, you can think the thought. The emotion you can't change. Same as also in the mind. If you have an idea, you can think that 2 + 2 = 5. Okay, okay. Now for the next minute, we're all going to have the thought, you can't accept intellectually that 2 + 2 = 5. Because 2 + 2 = 4, and you can't decide. Why? Because that's the inner structure of your intellectual character. The intellectual character is the inner structure of who you are, and the emotion also. So that's why we need to say this is not external. This is something that becomes, even though it's a garment, even intellect and emotions is a garment. Because we said before, the soul itself is simple, doesn't have any shape or any form, it doesn't have any character to it, beyond the character. Nevertheless, this is character that it bonds with, it becomes, just like when the soul becomes one with the body, the soul gets attached to the body in a manner where it can't shake the body off. The body becomes etched, or the soul gets etched in the body, that they become inseparable. And that's the idea we're saying over here. The two levels of Machshava Dibur HaMaisa versus thought, speech, and action versus Seichel and Midos. Let's read it inside of it. Umash HaKasa B'Tanya Sha'nefesh Atzmon Ischalekes L'Seichel and Midos. That the intellect itself, this that it says in Tanya, that the intellect itself is characterized by intellect, I'm sorry, that the soul itself is characterized by the intellect and the emotions. Shahab Nikron, Atmiyas HaNefesh, they're called what? The very essence of the soul. Ein zeh elo legabo machshava dibur ha'maaseh. This is only a relationship when you're comparing it to thought, speech, and action. Shehem levushin nifradin mamash. They are literally garments that are separable or separate from the soul. Numuhus HaNefesh, from the essence of the soul. Shehein Chinez Biyah, which in the upper realm, when we're speaking about God, now he's going to relate this idea. Just like human beings have what? We have two. We have the human soul is a simple entity that doesn't have any shape, form, or image. Then there is the body of the soul, if we can say, or the psychological body of the soul. What's the psychological body of the soul? Is the intellect and the emotions, because that's the... that becomes part, that merges with the soul, right? So that's the intellect and the emotions are engraved, an image that is imprinted on the neshama, and the soul can't separate itself from its intellect and from its emotions. And then we have the more external aspect called thought, speech, and action, which aren't you, which is just something that is projected towards the outside, but it isn't the human being himself. So just like within a human being there is that, same too within God himself. There is a level of God called the Or Ein Sof, the infinite light of God. That's what we refer like the soul of man that is predefined. Doesn't have any character because it's beyond any character. It's a simple light of Hashem that pre-exists, a pre-definition. Beyond any, before any, and it's a simple... Then we have the Esser Sphirot, the 10 Sphirot, which is the level of Atzilus. Atzilus, the world of emanation, that's where God assumes a character. God takes on a certain personality, which is the personality that what about this? There God unites with these. When we speak about kindness over there, it's God's kindness. God is being kind. God is loving through the attribute of love. He has discipline through the attribute of discipline, of gevura, and so on and so forth. Then there is God's thought, speech, and action. What are thought, speech, and action? Those are the latter three worlds. The world of Bria is considered like Hashem thinking. So the creations of Bria are like God's thoughts, which is outside of Him. The creations of the world of Yetzirah are like God's words that He speaks. And the creations of the world of Asiya, which is our physical world, are like God's doings, His makings, things that He has done, the world of His Asiya, the world of action, His actions. So He says like this, Shehem b'chinas, the garments of thought, speech, and action, Shehem b'chinas b'yah, they're b'riya, yetzir, and asiya. They're the world of yetzir. And that is something other than Hashem. They're His creation. They're not Him. Shal zeh omar, which about this it says, levushin tekinas loin. That garments, levushin garments, tekinas loin, you have you have created for them, you have brought about, meaning, for the Esther Sephiros, for the 10 attributes, you have created garments. What are those garments? Those garments are thought, speech, and action. Which are the external aspect. The Inun Biyah, which is Briya Yetzir Asir, which isn't him. But the intellect and the emotions, even though that what, that really their garments, Einon Levushin Nefradim. Meaning, what do we mean their garments? Because their garments, because they're not the very essence of the soul. The soul only joins, emerges with them, like a garment. It dresses itself in it. But the superiority of these things is that what, their greatness over the other is Einon Levushin Nefradim Namish. They're not literally garments that are apart. They're in the like we say about the attributes of the world of Atzilus, or the world of emanation. We say over there, the Iyu v'garmiyu chad. It says about them that God is one with his garments. He's one with the vessels. And that's why sometimes you refer to them as the very essence of God, or the very essence of the soul. That the soul, the very essence of the soul is the intelligence and its emotion. But that's not the essence. It's still external. Ella, but rather, Shehei Nikroyan, however the Alter Rebbe says, here he wants to explain something about another very important point. When we're speaking about God's unity with the Esther Sephiros, and we're saying that he unites with them, and also within the human being, we say the human soul becomes completely merged with the personality traits, with the emotional character and the intellectual character, with the spheres of the soul. Yet, on the one hand, it's not you, but on the other hand, it becomes you. So in order to understand how much, how deeply one merges with their intellect and their emotions, so he's going to elaborate on the idea that the Zohar calls the Pasach Aliyo Anavi, when he refers to the Esher Sephiros, he doesn't call them garments, he calls them ornaments, he calls them like jewelry. What is El Shehen Nikra and B'Shem Tikunim? They're called ornaments. Shahanefes Mistakenes Umislabeshesem. The soul is impacted and impressed by and encloses itself through them. Meaning they have an impact on the soul itself. It's not just something that you temporarily are enclosed in, but in essence you remain completely, the soul remains completely clean. No, the soul doesn't remain completely clean. Because these things identify or imprint themselves upon the soul to create a certain character on the soul itself. Now the soul is characterized. It's not like there is the human being, that's simple. There is the I. And then there is something called love. And now my love, the love is being active. An external power called love, and love is being, like a push the button and love is working now. There is love emanating. No, that's not what's taking place. The human being themselves is loving. He's loving through his attribute of love. But that love becomes the character of the soul. So in order to understand this, the Alter Rebbe is going to elaborate on the idea of the ornaments. We know in garments, let's first use the example we were given before. Before we speak the difference in garments, the two types of garments, let's use the difference we were speaking about before, ordinary garments and the body. The body is also called a garment for the soul. So we have two types of garments. You have clothing you wear, and then you have the body as a garment. And the difference between the two, we said before, that the body is an inseparable garment, right? Because the neshama, the soul, merges with the body, they become one entity. However, the regular garments are separable garments. You can remove them, you can separate them. Understand this a little better. What is the difference between the relationship of a garment that is separate, but you enclose yourself in those garments, or a garment that becomes totally unified with the wearer of the garment? So to understand the difference, let's understand like this. The difference between the two is on how you affect the garment, how the wearer of the garment affects the garment, and how the garment affects the wearer. The difference between these two types of garments are in both directions. How the person affects the garment and how the garment. When you're wearing the garment, when you're wearing a, what? The body and regular clothes. The difference between the body being the garment and your shirt being your garment. The two types of garments. What is the difference? So one thing we said before is when the soul unites itself with the garment, you can't remove the garment. That means that that's like the soul having an impact on the garment, that the garment is stuck to it. You can't remove the body from the soul. You can't separate the body from the soul. But regular garments, you can divest the garment. You can remove it. You can take them to the mom whenever you want. But then it also works the other way. A garment that let's say for example clothing doesn't have any impact on your soul, on your being. You wear clothing, ordinary clothing. I mean, there are a type of clothing that will say that do impact. That's more the idea of ornaments and jewelry. But regular clothes, they have an effect on the person. How do they affect on the person? They protect you, they shield you from the heat, from the sun, from the cold, or whatever it is. So the garments have a contribution to make to the human being. But they don't have any impression upon the person. What do I mean they don't have an impression? Meaning you are, you know, if you wear your blue hat today, you're either, it doesn't make a difference in you. You are what you are. Your clothing is, you know, you're wearing this or you're wearing that. When the neshama comes into a body, when the soul encloses itself in the body causes an extreme, a very powerful change on the soul. For example, all the powers, we understand, all the powers that a functioning human being has, from the power, from the intellect, and the emotions, your vision, the power to hear, the seeing, and all the various different powers that we have, we understand that the soul had all these powers prior to its vestment within the body. Because if the body is really a dead piece of meat. So if the body, all these powers stem from the soul. So definitely if the body has vision, where does that vision come from? That vision stems from the soul. If the body has a sense of smell, so that sense of smell comes from the soul, the same as the hearing and all the other capabilities and all those things. So they really originate and stem from the soul. It's only that what? So we understand as follows. That all these kaychus ha-nefesh, all these powers of the soul, prior to their coming to the body, were completely in a different form. For example, the vision of the soul. A bodiless soul, a bodily soul, its vision is incomparable to the vision. Not a physical vision. The spiritual vision is a completely different type of seeing. It has receptiveness, it's able to see, but its seeing is not, it doesn't, physical things don't register, spiritual things register. It has a far higher vision. In order for the vision of the soul to be defined and limited and to take on a physical object, and to be able to perceive a physical object, comes in the body. And once the kayach hariya, the power of vision, comes into the body, it's impacted. It has changed. It changes drastically to be able to become a physical sight. Same is also the intelligence. The intelligence of a soul, a soul in heaven, is immeasurably superior to the intelligence that the physical brain is able. When the soul's intellectual powers are vested within a physical brain, the whole realm of intellectual perception changes. Everything becomes what we call bahaksham. Everything becomes coarsened, thickened, because it's not. So you see that what? That every power of the soul, when it vests in the body causes a very powerful change, a very great transformation in those powers of the soul. Why? What? Garments, it reduces it. But it only reduces it, it changes it. It's physical, I think it's not the right word. It's almost like it physicalizes it. It takes it from a spiritual abstract way and defines it in physical parameters and physical terms. So that's what we mean, that with a garment that is unified, a garment that unifies, it's not only that you impress the garment impresses its character on the wearer of the garment. But your physical clothing, they don't really have an impression upon you. Whatever it is you wear, you're wearing.
But it doesn't have any impact, doesn't cause a transfer, because they're external, because you're not united with them. There's one type of garment that is different than that, and that is jewelry. When a person wears jewelry, the point of jewelry is, it's a type of garment where it's like a body, meaning the person is beautified by the jewelry that they wear. It's not like, okay, there is a person, there is you, and then there is jewelry, and there's beautiful jewelry. So if a person is wearing jewelry, where you notice jewelry, and you don't notice the person being beautiful through their jewelry, then it's the wrong kind of jewelry. The right kind of jewelry is not jewelry where there is you and there is jewelry, but the jewelry is, the ornaments are, they beautify, they merge into the person, and the person becomes beautified through, they bring out the beauty of the person. Same as also various types of clothing. There is clothing you wear, you just run out, you need to get out, so you just put on clothing, any clothing. But then there is clothing you put on, which you want it should present you. These clothing bring out, they have an effect by, they impress themselves, they bring out something. You're dressing elegantly. As you go out, you're dressed for a wedding or something like this. These are clothing already that are going to emerge within the human being to a person that they become the person. They're you, the clothing that you wear. So within clothing themselves, we have the first types of clothing. It doesn't go to the extreme like the body impresses upon the soul, on the soul. But it definitely, sometimes particular clothing, which will actually have an impact on the mood you'll have. It's in the type of clothing that you wear. That's why so many companies want their employees to wear clothing, what is it called, formal clothing. Because that formal clothing that you wear, that uniform that you wear, creates within the person want that formality, that seriousness, and so on. As a person, you're just wearing casual clothing. So here you have clothing that do cause an impact, do have. It's a deeper types of clothing. And that's what he explains with the idea of the Esser spheres. In that sense, those garments are like the body. Just like the body has what? An impact on the soul. Causes an impression. Causes it carves out a certain carving within the soul. So too, there's garments that have an impression on the person. Let's read it inside. Hello. Shehein nekroim, but the spheres are called, we're holding right after the parentheses on the first column. El shehein nekroim b'shem tikkunin, they are called tikkunin. Shehanefesh mistakenes umislabeshetem. The soul is again, even he's rectified it. The soul is impressed by these garments. The kamoisha targum inkelis, al pasik, just like the unkelis, the targum, translates on the pasik, la yil bashkeve simlashisha, a man may not put on, not when adorn himself with women's clothing. So the Targum says, well, you're talking gavar, the tikkune itza. He says a man should not, he uses the word you're talking, which is interesting, because usually the usual translation for yilbash, for levushim, for garment, in the Targum is levush, in some Aramaic, with some Aramaic flavor. But that albish, or something like that, but the idea is levush. Levush means a garment. But specifically when it speaks that a man is not allowed to wear women's clothing, the Targum changes it from the word yilbash and uses lo yitaking. Why does the Targum? And it says bitikune yitz. Bitikune yitz means with the ornaments of a woman. Because it says in the Gemara that only what type of women's clothing is a man not allowed to wear? Women digde savainen, which means women elegant clothing. Clothing that are there to beautify. That type of clothing is what a man is now going to put on of a woman's clothes. So, but just the plain, if you're running out and you grab a sweater and it's a woman's sweater and it's not exactly, that's not the thing. The point is that it's clothing that is meant to be, to impress and beautify that element of clothing, which identify, which merge, which become unified with the wearer, and which brings out the woman of the woman. So that type of clothing a man is not going to put on. So you see that there are clothing that have an impression. The Indian tikkun and the idea of tikkun in Malash and tachshit. Tikkun comes from what? From the meaning of tachshit, ornaments. Shemeskashit, boy, that one is beautified in it, to mispal men. And one becomes impressed by the thing that they wear. Vahare misachit in tachshit zeh. That you become united with this jewelry. Ki'ilu hu magifay mamish. That's as if This is part of their body. Just like the body and the soul. So for this type of garment, he wants to give an example for this type of garment, a unified garment. So a unified garment is a good example, he says, is the body. The body is a garment for the soul. So this clarifies, because in the body we see the extreme of it, where you can have something that is really in essence completely apart. The soul is spiritual, and this is a physical entity. But nevertheless, they merge and they become one. Shaguf ulavush la'nefesh. The body is a garment for the soul. The kolmok, and nevertheless, hadeya nefesh mispa'eles v'mikrei aguf. The soul is impressed by the occurrences that happen to the body. He's going to explain how the body impacts the soul. So we learned earlier the general impact that the body has on the soul. Once, that means in order for a soul to come into a body, the soul gets completely, takes on a complete metamorphosis, a total change, transformation, as the soul enters into the body, it gets coarsened and relates to the realm of the physical. But now the Rebbe is going to say, not only is it in general, but it's a continuous thing, that the soul is impressed by the body. Just for example, when you hurt your finger, the soul immediately feels it. I understand one thing, the soul in itself is a spiritual being that has absolutely no relationship to whatsoever to physical pain. The spirit, while the soul is a spirit, it can't bang its finger. Because there's no matter, there's nothing to bang on. It doesn't have that ability to sense physical pain. But nevertheless, once the soul merges with the body, what happens? You bang your finger and you feel pain. Now who feels the pain? You can say, the body is hurting, my body hurts. Not my body hurts, I'm hurting. I have a headache. I have a headache, or I have a toothache, it's hurting me. And the entire person hurts, the soul. So you're hurting from that pain, even though it's a physical deficiency. It hurts, but nevertheless, it hurts the soul. Why? Because the soul has become identified, completely identified with the body. In a sense, the soul has taken on a physical form. You see? Because that shows the extreme of how much they merge. Saying, that's why showing how the body impacts the soul. And now he's going to say also how the power of a soul, how the body identifies with the soul. We're learning now, till now he explained how the soul identifies with the body. Every bodily pain is felt instantly within the soul. But now the opposite, how the body is impacted and becomes identified with the soul, therefore it is, Chayn, Masha'ola, Beratzen HaNefesh, Lufay Leizapu'ula. When it arises within the desire of the soul to have an effect, to do any activity, to be Eivarim with the limbs, Heivarim, Nishmoim, Leratzen Zeh, Peikov, Miyat. The organs respond to this desire, to this command, or this, no, not command, to this desire of the soul, instantly. As soon as it arouses with one's desire to do something, spontaneously, on the instant, the soul, what? Simultaneously, together, it responds. The feet move to walk and so on. And where there is absolutely no need for time to elapse between it coming down from the brain for it to get the regal to the leg. Because if it would be so, it would take time. The Rebbe is saying if there's no time. When as soon as you have a desire to do something, the body dances with the soul with complete harmony. It moves the instant, any movement, anything of the soul's desires, wants, instantly impacts the body. Without any, now what do we mean? So someone said, what do you mean? There's no time. There is the neurological process that's taking place. It ever seems to be saying the leg moves automatically. It's not even going from the mind to the leg. Alpha Rebbe doesn't mean maybe that millimeter of a second, because it's not so much this idea of the physical process. But what Alpha Rebbe means is one thing. You know, we know that the body is submissive to the soul. That we know. But the body listens to the soul. It never happens that you want to do something and the body's just not going. And if you do, then it's a real serious problem. Then the person needs a doctor. But if you're trying to move your fingers, you really want to, and the finger won't budge, and the finger starts arguing because it doesn't want, it is a problem. So we know that the body is submissive to the soul. But the Rebbe is saying it's not just submissive. Not submissive. Not submissive. The body is merged, is unified with the soul. When the soul wants something, it's as if the body wants it. Not the two things. So there is, for example, the idea of a chariot. A chariot, or horse, is submissive, subservient to the rider. And there it also works very quickly. As soon as you pull the reins this way, the horse will move to the right. You turn it the other way, it will move to the left. You're transmitting, you're telling, you put... But here's like this. Here there is the idea of taking time. Even though it's a very little bit of time, it's time. Why is it time? Because where is the urge, the desire to go, where is that felt? That's not felt in the horse. To go right or to go left, there's two ways to go. That's your desire. That's your decision. You want to go wherever you want. Now, you have to transmit that information or that thing to the horse. So that takes time. Why time? Because time means the fact that it has to leave you and it has to go into the space, into that world of the horse. It has to go from you to the horse. The transmission is time. The body and soul, there is no time. It's not like the limbs are nullified to the body. You want, and then they surrender themselves. That's called Merkava, that's not called Eivarim. Organs aren't surrendered to the soul. Organs are one. Because when you want something, you are your body and your soul. So when the soul wants to go somewhere, it heals itself as if the body wants it. That's why it works so instantaneously, so simultaneously. At the moment, it's there, it happens. Because they're totally mirrored, they become one. They identify. External garments, clothing are not that way. There is something outside of you, attached to you, but not you. And now, when we're speaking about, another way where we can see this, just one second, one more thing I think where we can see this. We see, and it doesn't say it over here, and I'm speaking to you this week about this, that the expressions of the soul of things that are clearly, they're not physical things, show themselves so clearly on the body. The face is a face, right? It has its structure, its thing, and it's amazing how a face looks different. When you're happy, when you're sad. When you're experiencing an epiphany, a new idea, you're sitting in the chair and suddenly, wow, you can see a light bulb go on. There's nothing that happened in the chemistry of the body. I mean, it wasn't like something took place. Something happened in the soul. You've gotten an idea, and a brilliant idea, and you lit up from it. But that thing, you can instantly, that is shown in the eye. Now here's the thing, the soul doesn't want to show anybody this. You can say, wow. Now when you want to move, the soul really was the one that wants to go. The body is really something other. The soul wants to go, but the soul has such control that it imparts it so quickly and the body listens. Like the horse and the rider. Here, when you've gotten an idea, you're not trying to show anybody. This is an experience, this is an experience that's taking place within the soul. And the soul isn't interested in conveying that excitement to anybody. But whether you want to convey it or whether you don't want to convey it, the body conveys it. Why does the body convey it? Because the body is happy. Why is the body happy? Because the soul got the idea. Now the body is physical, it's not shy as to what I, it's not any relevant, no connection to an idea. But it does get that excitement. So sick, shame, you're embarrassed. What about shock? These are all things that instantly, the whole form, the change, and you can see the change. That shows on the utter unification and oneness of body and soul. How they're completely one. Even though they couldn't be farther than each other. To the point that in order to bond body and soul together, it says it's a miracle of miracles. God does wonders. The greatest wonder is to take something that is spiritual, like a soul, and merge it with the body. But once they come together, they become completely guf echad. They become one entity, one being. Basar echad. One flesh. One entity. And that is the idea, how much he's going to explain, and that's the idea of the Esher spheres. On the one hand, they're light years away of God, and light years is not even the word. They're incomparable to him in any way, because Ein Sof has no definition, no... But nevertheless, he emanates these spirits, and he merges with these spirits to the point where he is them and they're him. Becomes totally united with them. Yeah, so you have a question? That's really because we're dealing over here in Nefesh HaLekis, Nefesh HaBahamas. Because we have another element of soul. So when we're speaking soul over here, we don't mean Dafke, Neshama, Al-Neshama. We mean the battery. So the battery of the spirit. So a man has an ego, and that's part of the spirit of man. And that's what's interfering. But if a person wouldn't have that, then it would be just Nefesh HaLekis in the body. And let's say the body would be able to respond to the stimuli of a Nefesh HaLekis, even though it's... Then automatically the tenua of the body would go.
What
are you saying? Yeah?
So are you talking about the power that allows the body to move?
Yeah, that element.
So without that power, the body would be able to do that.
Without the soul.
Right.
But the Nefesh HaLekis.
It could be the body is.
Is still, in other words, it's like, for example, you put on a pair of gloves. The glove can't either move without the body. So it moves along with the body. But it remains, in essence, apart, even though it's moving, but it's like a dead thing that's being swept away. Well, you think, no, the body becomes alive. Because the neshama goes into every cell of the body. It merges with it completely, to the point that becomes a living body. Yeah. Emerges to become completely one. Between body and soul. And that's a synthesis, it identifies with it.
How would we learn otherwise?
We learn otherwise that it's two, it's a
remote control?
No, it's like this is this, and this is impacting an effect on that.
So it's
powering it, yeah. Yeah. But what is the mind? The mind is a physical brain that also needs a soul to operate it. What is the mind? The mind is also a flesh. So that too. The mind is also the mind is the most sophisticated part of the human flesh, but nevertheless it's still a physical brain is a physical brain. And the physical brain, after the soul departs, is dead. I think you need to say for those people who argue that there is no spirit. No, they have a spirit. They have a spiritual dimension. They have a spirit. They don't have a neshama, what we call neshama, but they have a nefesh abahema. They have a soul of an animal, and that's a total spiritual entity. And by them too, that spirit enters into the body, and there is and that's what's alive. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, we're speaking over here. He's not getting into Nefesh HaBahamas, Nefesh HaLekis. He's getting into the general idea of the emergence of spirit with matter, with the soul and body. Not. Now, okay,
sorry.
Yeah. Oh, you don't think now he's going to compare it to the Ether Spheres? Let's see it inside. Yeah.
The intellect and the emotions make up the personality, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. What did you say about the character? I didn't think that. What part of the character is separating character from personality?
No, the personality, that's what I mean by character. When we say the character, we mean that personality of the intellect. Yeah, yeah, let me go. Yeah. So now we're going
to...
Yeah, that's right. So now he's going to say that what? This idea that there is external garments and there is internal garments, there are merging garments, unified garments, and separate garments. This explains also the psychological composition of the human being, which means the relationship of the person to his intellect and emotions versus the relationship of the human being towards the thought, speech, and action. Thought, speech, and action, like we spoke earlier, is why external garments. Which means you can remove them, and more than that. Also, they don't impact you. What do you mean they don't impact you? Of course, you're impacted to a certain degree by the thing you're doing. But still, action is like something you're doing outside of you. You're doing something. It's not defining you. When you love someone, it's not like you're, there is love. As we said before, this is imprinting love on you. The person is far more merged in that love. It contains the entire human being. You are loving. When you understand something, it's you understand. When you're doing something, you're doing. Of course, you're doing. But that's what I mean. Meaning to say in the idea that it's outside. You're speaking. And even thinking. It's like, it's not that identified with you. It's a thing that you're doing. It's not the thing that you are. It's not, you're not that.
It's part of you, but not the essence. Right?
But no. Even the intellect and the emotions are also not the essence.
Right.
But over there, the intellect and the emotions become engrave themselves onto you. That so there's always a place within you that's deeper than that. That is still, because when we say they engrave, we don't mean that they capture. The engravement goes through and through, because there is always that place of simplicity, or that essential place within the human being. And that's why you could change your intellect, you could change your emotions with a lot of work, because there's a place where you're free from it, and that's your very, very essence that transcends even that image, which we could say you generally is what? Is your essential character. But it's only your essential character. There is an essence that's deeper than that essential character. Okay? Well, now let's read inside. Well, Kamoi Kein. Ach. Here we are. The Ach, however, Ainza Elo, this is the Ach Ainza, this effect isn't Elo, Meshaguf, Meshach, the Manet. It's because the body unifies with the soul, Vanefesh Payalus by Tritsoina. And the soul affects through the body as it wishes, as if it would literally be essentially one. As if they would really be one. In essence, they're not one, but it's as if they would really be one. The asha gufulavush anefesh, and even though the body is only a garment of the soul, makomakon, nevertheless, umusachid anefesh, it becomes completely unified with the soul. Based on this, we'll also understand the intellect and the emotions of the soul. They're also called ornaments and garments. The soul becomes what? Impressed by them, by the intellect and by the emotions. And he now is going to, it's not only that the soul gets impacted, but when the character, the passions, the love, the fears of a human being, they impress that the person becomes loving. You have fear, right? So they impact you. But also, just like jewelry, better the person. They beautify the person. So too, we're using the idea of jewelry, although we're using the word ornament, because they beautify. The character of the intellect and the emotion actually cause an improvement, or the right word. They improve the soul. What do we mean they improve the soul? They improve the soul in the sense that the soul gets the ability through them to relate to the outside. Because without the Esther Sephiris, without the Kreikha Shanesh, without the powers of the soul, so privately the soul existing within itself, within its own sphere of existence, the soul would be perfect. It doesn't need anything. But for it to relate to the outside, how do you relate to anything? First begins with an understanding. You understand, you're aware of it, you know it. So it's through your intellectual powers that you have that you have an awareness and a recognition of things. Then, that's not an intellect, but intellectually you're still distant from things. You can know things, but you keep, there's still a great divide and separation. What draws you close to things that you should engage something and interact with something? So that is caused by the emotions. Now that you know it, now that you recognize it intellectually, and you understand its value, so what happens next? You're drawn to it emotionally. So the emotion and the intellect is what serves as a hook, to hook the person to other things, to enable you to attach yourself to things outside of you. And that's why they're called the improvements of the soul. They improve you, but by saying that, we're also saying how alien they are in essence, because it's something that is really only needed for the person to go to exit himself, to relate to the outside. Because intrinsically for yourself, you wouldn't need the intelligence, because with intelligence you know everything that's outside, but for yourself you wouldn't need it. And also the emotions. Emotion is always an emotion towards something. A feeling towards something. A love towards a human being, a fear of a human being, a love, an appetite towards something, a dislike towards something. So everything, all emotions are you versus something else. So that shows that what? That these things are external because they're the outer part of the person, the part of you that relates to the outside. But the inner private, most intimate inner self of the human being wouldn't need the intelligence and the emotions, and therefore it's not characterized by that. It is an entity that we don't understand what it is, because we can't understand this, because this is the place that's beyond understanding. Right? This is the intellect is intellect. This is a simple thing that is predefined, and there is no understanding of what it is. Let's read inside. Shehein, Damkin, Shanefs, Mistakenens, and Mislabesh of them. The soul is improved and enclosed in them. Behem, Kliya Nefesh, and they are the tools of the soul. Shebehem, Valyodam, Payelis, and Nefesh. It's with them and through them that the soul has an effect. Kidarizim, the other Chaytibut. Like an axe in the hand of the one that's chopping. So it's a tool. But Lehoy is the midas ahava. It's a tool, an instrument, but at the same time, it's an instrument that causes a carving within the soul itself. It is affected in it. It defines itself by these tools. It's not just an outer tool that it uses. It defines itself in these instruments. So it's not, so it gains the ability, let's say for love. Love would mean the attraction to something. But who is attracted? You're attracted in it. You're captured in that attraction. The soul. The soul itself is captured in that attraction. It causes a what's the right word? No, not a rift. It causes an image. It causes an impression on the soul. Allah has been the Sahaba to love with the attribute of love. Allah has to be Chachma and to intellectually understand through Chachma. All this and the like are only the doings of the soul, its expansion. Is only from the person to the outside, to someone other than yourself. But the soul by itself is higher than all these things. And in the biggest proof, maybe not. Maybe the intellect and the emotions are what define the human being at his inner core. Maybe that's who you are. You're a composite of intellectual powers and emotional powers. Who says there is a deeper I that goes deeper than the intellectual I or than the emotional I? Who says there is an I that is not defined by what? By what I love and I dislike and what I understand and what I do. Maybe that's all there is. You are what? You are your mind and your heart, your feelings and your intellect. So that's the deepest what you. That's who you are. Is something deeper than that. So to prove that, the Alter Rebbe says is like this: you see that it's not you, because that's the part of that aspect, the intelligence and the emotions are constantly changing. Shade, before we learn how they not, they don't change. It's hard to change them, but eventually through life, what happens? The person matures, and the maturity is what. One is mainly the maturity of a person. It's your maturity of emotion. You change your emotion and your feelings towards things. Your emotions usually grow to more important, significant things as you grow older in your life. And the same is also the intelligence grows. Now the soul doesn't change. The time, physical life, being older and younger is something that's happening in the body. The soul is an eternal being, and therefore not impacted by time. So if we're saying over here, there is young, when there is a childish emotions and mature emotions, there is a childish mind and an adult's mind, which means that the process of the aging has changed it, that means that this can't be the soul, because the soul doesn't age. What does age? The body ages. You know what else ages? That aspect of the soul that mingles with the body, those aspects of the soul that are intertwined in the body, being that the body changes, they change. And what is that? That is the intellect, the emotions, that's the way the soul impresses or relates, comes into the body. The mind and all, that aspect, which are external to the soul, that changes. The soul itself doesn't change. Let's read it inside this. Sha'arei ha-seichel v'amidus inside, because the intellect and the emotions have mekablam shinuyim. They are vulnerable to change. The midos, because in the emotions, yes, katnus v'katnus. We know in emotions there are emotions can be in a katnus in a minor state, the godless and in an expansive and a greater. Shakot in the child, oyev dvarim tapanim. desires or loves silly things, small things. And but they got older, that changes. And also the intellect, as long when a person grows and gets older, that changes. Then the mind changes. All this wouldn't be possible in the very essence of the soul. This is not susceptible to change. And this is not impacted by changes of occurrences in the body. Why? Because its very essence is not enclosed in the body. If the essence of the soul would be enclosed in the body, then the body changes, the soul would change. But the essence, the very identity, inner identity, is not enclosed in the body. It's only the powers of the soul, the intellect, the mind, the more external one. And that changes then. Ella harasel, but kechasel, shahana, shahana, mispasigul. Only its radiance and its powers, which are not the soul, which don't define the soul themselves, that is what expands itself in the body. Mislabesh is going enclosed in it. Hey, mekabim shinuyim mitzadaguf. They're what are impacted and changeable from because of the body. As a result of the body that is receiving the soul, the katan kach, with a child, its soul, will be zaken kach, and with an elderly person, the maturity of the body brings about a maturity of the mind. The brain, physically, the brain changes. The growth of the mind, the brain, that takes on a change. So too, the intellect, which is vested in it, like we said earlier, that the intellect emerges with the brain. So in the development of the physical brain, there is the development of the mind of the soul too. But that's only as dealing with those external aspects. The gamma stocking. The gamma sechovamidis ainaraka oris fanatish vikrechesel. So too the intellect and the emotions are only the radiance of the soul and its powers, Hamas Pashat is the goof, that expand in the body. The ainum apsmi sanatish muhusa, but they're not the very essence of the soul and its being. Ella, rather, shanefesh prayelis and mispashetis b'kreches ba'aris alalu. However, the Rebbe is adding over here, the Alter Rebbe, a very important thing. It's true, it's not the soul itself. It's only, as he mentioned before, external aspects, the radiance of the soul. But nevertheless, it's the soul itself, it's the very eye of the person that is intellectualizing through the intellect. It's the very eye of the person that's loving through the love. So we have the two extremes. On the one hand, it's totally not you. On the other hand, the person himself, that undefinable you, becomes defined, defines itself through these channels of definition of the intellect and the emotions. Yes.
So the child,
the essence of the neshama. But the neshama, when the neshama goes out of the body, the neshama goes with its seichel and its midos also. And therefore, those elements need to be purified. The whole process of that has to be purified. The essence of the neshama doesn't need purification. But it goes to levushim. It's not called levushim, because that, and we say, the levushim needs machshava dibur ha'mais over there. That element of the neshama needs the most purification. Even the seichel and the midos, the intellect and the emotions, that's impressionable, so they need to be cleansed and purified. And the very essence of the soul always remains clean. That's why it's interesting that depending on how someone wrecks his soul, and say how badly someone, especially for someone made mistakes. You make sure, because you were not so careful. So the problem the person made, they weren't so careful in their actions. But their heart and soul, they're really loyal to God, and they're. But there was some, you know, out of result of what a little negligence and so on and so forth. So that type of purification, which immediately that has to be scrubbed off. So in a certain sense, those little nuances of your personality have to get ripped away. It's a little piece of you that gets separated, but that's not really it. If a person gets hashmirt, if he gets himself soiled on a deeper level, meaning emotionally you get consumed with unholiness, with klipa and so on and so forth, so then that element also has to be cleaned. And so what happens is, after the cleansing of the soul, see, every neshama goes to Olam Haba, every soul. The question is only one thing: how much of the original you goes there? Because sometimes so much of it has to be stripped and torn away, so much that what you identified with.
What's left.
So what's left? So every Jew goes to Olam Haba because the essence is pure Olam. But some people come to the world to come and become retaining who they were then is also here because their entire being, even their external stuff, is whole. So they're the same human being. Others are not recognizable. Because it's only their quintessential self that is pure. But so many layers have to be stripped away because their mind, their heart, and so on have been corrupted. So this is very important. Seichel Amidus is very important. Because we want to remember ourselves and want to connect to that. It shouldn't be just a different human being. It's you. You want to come with your entire being. First of all, then it would be Bahagbala, it would be limited, it would be a composite, right? No, but then it wouldn't be in essence eternal, because the Rambam says anything that is put together from Yisoyevus, from various things, must eventually run apart. So if you have a few things put together that comprise an element, then it must be, it will separate eventually. And then you lose the person. Because if what you are, no, an Hashem is eternal. It's forever. And that's one aspect. And since since the Eibishter wants us to be able to study and Zolakai, also to know the Eibishter, and in Oirin Tzoyf, there is that love that the faith that the Esses Spheres are just external. So therefore, it's only a yeah. Yeah, that's a question. Yes, I'm Asian. Who? Tzadikim, yeah, even their bodies remain. That's right, because even the body has become completely merged with their soul and pure and whatever. It doesn't need that decomposing, yeah. Even, that's right. No, that's right. Now, I'll bet if they even got Lamaila, so based on all this, we'll also understand above. The Yud Svidish and Nikra Tekun. Same is also applies to the 10 attributes that are called ornaments. Bahainu, which means chachma midas. We mean the intellect, the wisdom, the chachma and midas and the emotion. The atzilus of the world of atzilus. The iu v'garmiu, which the world of atzilus means the world of emanation. The iu v'garmiu chat. Well, there we say that he and his ornament and his garments are one. Which means that they're totally unified with him. Just like what we said before, that the person becomes joins with his intellectual and emotional character. Avo dia, but he says parentheses of it. But bria yasira asiyah. When we're dealing with the outer levels of the world of creation, over there already that's not him. We say that's a creation. So the creatures of the world of bria, they're not him. They're creations of him. So hen b'chinas levushin mamish. They're considered literal garments, garments, separable garments. Yes, God vests himself in them. The energy of Hashem vests them, but they Ba'aleyam amar levushin tekinas lo. And then we say that garments you have ordered for them or created for them. So now he's going to explain how all this that we learned before applies to us, applies to the Hashem and the Esesir. It says in Pasach Eliyahu, as we mentioned before, further in the it says, Antu Chakim, that you are what? Antu Chakim, you are wise. Piddish, meaning Amtu. What does it mean Am? Hainu Oirin Soif Chak. At the very Oirin Soif, you are wise. See, in the beginning we said before, what did we say? How does the Pasuk Yo begin? Amtu Chad Veloy Bechushba. God, you are one, you're not with a countable one, you're not with a numeric one. Your oneness is totally, you transcend all images, you transcend all definitions, all character, all personality. Amtu Chad. Then it goes ahead and it says, Amtu Chakim. Then it says you created, 1 second, Amtu Dapika Sesosphere. You emerged, emanated of, you bringing about Eser Tekunin, the Tenna. The ten garments, so the ten vessels, the ten attributes. So if we would just say that, we would think that what? That these are two elements. There is God himself, and then there are things that are not him. These are tools, instruments, through which God relates to the world. Just like we said before, that through a person's emotions, like malachim, we would think that they're entities separate from him, that he has created, as if to say, other beings, and through them God relates to the world, but they're not him. That's why he continues and he says, no, antu chakim, you are wise. Meaning the very you that we said before is completely unknowable. The very you that utterly transcends any image, you are wise through the attribute of wisdom. Antu chakim, because you assume wisdom. Because that character becomes characterized within God. He assumes that character. He, in other words, we said many times, he assumes a personality. Even though in essence, he chooses to define himself in a certain personality. And that's the idea. Even though the personality is infinitely lower than him, has absolutely no relevance, no comparison to him whatsoever, nevertheless, this is the way he chooses to relate and to be. Antu chakim, antu haynu oyring seif chakim shenimshach bebchenas chacham, that he is drawn in chacham, that he comes in, meaning that he is drawn into the spheres of chacham. Now it's interesting. 2 weeks ago we learned the Maamar of Parshas Noach, where he mentions also this idea of antu chakim, that you are chakim, but over there he explains the level of antu chakim on a far loftier level than he explains it over here. Because over there, if you remember, just briefly, I'm just going to mention it, he explains like this. There is the Esa spheres, and there is the 10 attributes, Chachma, Bina, Das, and so forth. Then afterwards it says, Antu Chakim, you are wise, V'loi b'chachma yediya, but not with any knowable wisdom. Right? So he says like this. When it says that God, you're wise, not with knowable wisdom, doesn't mean God's vesture, Hashem's investment in the Esa spheres. Because if Hashem vests himself in the Esa spheres, that is called Chachma yediya. That's called already a known Chachma. Because from Chachma of Atzilus will come Chachma of Bria, and from Chachma of Bria will come Chachma of Yetzirah, and from Chachma of Yetzirah will come Chachma of Asiyah, and from Chachma of Asiyah is something we know, so we can have some inclination, some knowledge of what? Of God's wisdom. So even Chachma of Atzilus is already called what? Chachma Yediyah. Meaning a known Chachma, a known wisdom. Since we say you are known, you have wisdom and not with a known wisdom, if we're not referring to Hashem's vesture, Hashem's enclosing himself in the essences, we're speaking about the element of chakim, of wisdom, in the Ein Sof, completely in the Ein Sof, prior to Hashem, more on the level of keser, of a crown. In the total transcendental state, and explained the idea which we elaborated then on the Esses Sfiris HaGnuzos, the Matzila, the 10 attributes that are completely incorporated in the Ein Sof. As they are in him, where they hardly can be called spheres. Okay, they're not definable. All the spheres are just, they're even higher than potential. We spoke then. It's not even potential, because potential is too much, giving it too much existence, defining it too much. That's what we spoke then. And that's what he means. And on the very level of Ein Sof, prior to your emergence, there is already an aspect of Chacham. Here in the Maamar, the Alter Rebbe explains it differently. Explains Antu Chakim, referring to the Ein Sof, channeling himself down into the spheres of Chachma. But nevertheless, even though God comes down and unites himself with the spheres of Chachma, it's still called Lo B'Chachma Yediyah. Because even the Chachma Vatzilus is not called a known Chachma. That's what he's going to elaborate over here. In that Maamar, he said that Chachma Vatzilus is called Chachma Yediyah, it's called known wisdom. And only as Chachma is higher than Atzilus, it's called the unknowable wisdom. But now in this Maamar, he's going to explain the level of Loi B'Chachma Yediyah, that the Chachma is not any type of conceivable wisdom. He's going to explain it on the level of, but this is all parenthetically. Let's get into the Maamar as he explains. What does he say? When I was learning it, and the reason I mentioned it, it was bothering me a lot because it seemed a clear contradiction to what. So a lot of times we have in Chassidus that we have the same thing explained on many levels, and sometimes he takes a higher road to explain it on a higher realm, in a more abstract way, and sometimes he says that really it applies even on a lower level because everything is relative. So relative to higher, this Chachma Vatzilus is called Chachma Yediyah, not known. But in our mind, relative to real Chachma, as it is in creation, Chachma Vatzilus is called Loi B'Chachma Yediyah, not known. No.
That
The opposite. The spheres of Atzilus are called tikkunin because they're like ornaments, which, or like jewelry, as we said before, that beautify the wearer. They become part of it. And the spheres of bria are called levushin because they're external garments. Kihine, as explained, antu chakim. Piddish, meaning antu hayne oiring soif chakim. The very Ein Sof is wise. Shenimshach betchinas chakim. He is drawn in the level of chacham. Al derech. Now, even though he is another thing, the distance between the Ein Sof and chachma and the Esser Spheres there is an infinite gap. There's absolutely God and the Esser Spheres are so apart. The Esser Spheres are so inferior to the Ein Sof. So. It's there is absolutely no connection whatsoever. Nevertheless, we're saying that God lowers himself down and he vests himself in it to assume that personality. That's the idea which it says in Chazal, the Makam Sha'atamoitsa, which means in the place where you find God's greatness, you find his humility. Meaning, greatness of God means God's power to create as it emanates in the world of Atzilus. Let's take an example, the power of Chesed, kindness of God, which is the power through which God creates infinite amount of worlds and being and creations, myriads of levels and all these different things, which that's where we appreciate God's greatness. We look at the awesome creation, we expound, we learn, we study, we see that it's uncountable, it's unknowable, God's greatness, and we're impressed with the Hashem's greatness. But that's the greatness as it is coming through Chesed of Atzilus, as a God is exercising greatness through the power of Chesed. So we say that greatness is only great to us. For Hashem to express himself in that greatness, he has to lower himself, he has to humble himself immeasurably to come down to that place. So similar to that, the Rebbe says, is the whole idea of God coming into the Esser Sphere. It's a tremendous belittling of himself. It's a lowering, it's contracting himself, as we're going to see soon, how the Rebbe explains it, how what this means. They're the tikkunim, they're ornaments. That's right, that's the paradox. They're not separate from him, only when he merges with them. In essence, they're so apart from him that it's like you merging with a stone. And that's also, a human being is much closer to a stone than God is to the Esser Spheres. They're totally apart. But nevertheless, he contracts himself to that place that he is that. So that they're not separate. That's the paradox. They're not, in essence they're not, because he's infinitely beyond them, but he lowers himself down to become them, to merge with them and become them. Yeah. They beautify him in the sense that they present him to the others. What do you mean to beautify yourself? Usually, your person puts on jewelry and so on to go out. Yourself, you don't need it. You're running out to. You can wear clothing, but that's not ornament. Ornaments you wear to present yourself to the Alpha. Show to God to present himself to a world. We call it beautifying. It's not really beautifying. It's to relate. Yeah. Those are the attributes of Atzilus. Those are the ornaments which he beautifies himself to be able to have, assuming some character, from the level of super character, beyond character, he assumes character by coming into the Esser Spheres, and that's the beauty. So now, this is similar, where you find God's greatness, you find his humility. However, the Rebbe says, let's understand something. Chachma of Atzilus is also not something to sneeze at. It's not the, when you think God lowers himself down, so it's infinitely lowering, and therefore, he comes into the realms of Chachma. The Rebbe says, no, let's understand. The Chachma that we're speaking about, God's Chachma, is a level of Chachma that is utterly transcends our wildest imagination. We can't have any inkling of what that Chachma means. The only thing we can say about it is, the only relationship that has to Chachma that we have, is that it has the same name. Chachma. But in character, in essence, it is so beyond. I mean, for us to sit over here Thursday night after we ate bagels and cream cheese, and to talk about the divine attributes is the most ridiculous thing possible, because we have no choice, because we have to inspire ourselves with something. So, because we have, it's in any way that our physical minds can relate, and it's, because it's not only us, it's even the most sublime celestial beings who have the most refined, detached chachma. They too have absolutely no inkling of what it means, divine chachma. That's the point he's going to bring down. That Hashem's chachma is not knowable. Loi b'chachma yediyah. V'adayin, even after that tremendous descent from the Ein Sof, where he takes that quantum leap and comes down into the world of chachma, we're dealing with infinite wisdom. We're dealing with a whole different camp. V'adayin ein achakim b'chachma yediyah. It's not known wisdom. Why is he called Chachim? We can't even define it as Chachma. The only thing we can say, why is it called Chachma? Because Chachma comes from there. Wisdom comes from there. To call it Chachma is ridiculous, because it's infinite. It's totally on a whole different realm of existence. So we can't, and calling it a name is giving it too much imagery, giving it too much definition. It's limiting it. It's only that from there stems chachma. All power, all intelligence in the world, bria, yetzir, and asiyah, it stems from there. Hagam she'ein aroi chachma de bria. Even though the chachma of bria has absolutely no relationship, no significance in compared to the chachma of atzilus. The kolshkin da'asiyah, the sure wisdom, the way we know it down here in our world, definitely has no connection. That we should call him Chakim because he's the source of this. Because it's so, our chachma, to that chachma, is so detached that it's hard to say that just because that's the source of this, that's what we're going to call it chachma. But nevertheless, since it's the source of the source, as we're going to see soon, it's ultimately the source. We also define it as chachma. We give it that the name chachma. So to understand this idea that what? Well, we can have one thing coming from the other thing, but at the same time, we have to understand the total aloofness and the total separateness. Even though one is the same as the other. For example, we're speaking about Chachma, and we say God has Chachma. Understand that this comes from that, but it's so removed. The Rebbe is going to try to get it a little closer to our senses. He says like this, Hina Yo Inyan Yuvan, it's a beautiful example. So the idea will be understood of that Achmashal by way of analogy, Mamasha Amr, as all the sages tell us, Ein Lach Eis, Ein Lach Kol Eises, Momata She'ein Lemata. That there isn't a blade of grass down here that doesn't have a spiritual mazel, spiritual energy or force that makes it grow. So every flower, every plant has its counterpart, has its source in the upper realm. Some kind of angel, if we can say. Some kind of spiritual spirit or something that is the source of this thing. The Gavoya Ma'al Gavoya. And then that source, that mazel, that spiritual mazel, that's the source of this thing, has even a source in a higher realm of existence. And that has a sense. So if there is daisies and tulips down here, it's because there is daisies and tulips in a higher world, and even that is higher, and orange and apples and even avocados, they go all the way up to the highest realms of whatever they mean. Okay, so they have their bare, because everything in this world is evolved from upper every aspect of them, their color and their taste and their sweetness and their sharpness and their this, all these things exist before. So you think about bare, you think like this. Let's analyze this. He uses apples. We have apples. So we have various kinds. Apples, there are various kinds of apples. You have a Macintosh, and you have a Gala apple, and a sweet, and a Granny Smith apple, and a red, sweet red, what are the red ones? Those the very sweet ones? Whatever. So there's various different types of apples. So now, let's understand that. The sweetness in the apple, we know is a sweetness, that your physical palate, the physical sensor in your mouth senses that sweetness. Okay, where did that sweetness come from? If there's the apple is sweet down here, it must be sweet in its source too. What's the source of the apple? So the first source of the apple is what? The power of vegetation that's in the earth. That God gave in a kayach hatzemeach, the power of growth. Now, it has to be that if the sweetness is in the apple, the sweetness has came from somewhere. So there must have been some element of sweetness in that pot. So can you taste that? Can you imagine what the taste is of the sweetness that's in this koyach ha-tzameach, in the power of growth that's in the earth? What's the sweetness? We understand that it must be there, but what? It's a different kind of sweetness. Our physical senses cannot taste that sweetness. Let's go higher. And where does that sweetness come from? It comes from the mazel. It comes from the apple up there, from that mazel. And that mazel must also have a mesichus. It must have a sweetness. It's not just that it has a color, it has a texture, it has a sweetness. The sweetness of that mazel, what kind of sweetness is that? It's sweet because, again, because this is derived from that.
Green apple fruit.
The green, yeah, but what kind of sweetness is it? Or the sourness. So the sourness of the green apple, that must be a sourness in its mouth. And then higher than that, in a higher world, it exists there, and even higher. So what is it? So the Rebbe says, let's understand. Just to find an example. We know even in our physical realm, we can speak of various levels of sweetness. You have a sweet apple. You have a sweet piece of chocolate. Sweet. Then you have, people say, it's a sweet song. Or it's a sweet person. What's a sweet person? Or a sweet song. There's a sweetness to it. What kind of sweetness? Is there any resemblance from the sweetness of an apple to a sweetness of a song? On the one hand, you say no. There's no resemblance. But why do you call it sweet? Because it is. What do you mean? If a person has a spiritual sensor, a person has an ear for music, so you can taste. Sometimes there's a sweet song, some songs are a sour song. It brings depression, it puts you in a bad mood, it just... And there are certain songs that just... You can sense a sweetness to them. It's a sweet song. So, what is it? It's sweetness, but sweetness in a different realm of experience. There is sweetness in physical... For that you need not a physical sensor. The palate can't taste it. You have an emotional sensor that can sense the sweetness of a song. Then you have sometimes a sweet idea. You learn something, it's a great idea. I mean, it's cute. I mean, it's such a great idea, you can sense, ooh, it's so sweet. It's like sugar entered your mind somewhere. It's like you sense a yeast type, it's a sweetness. So what is that? It's also sweetness. And that's, can you in any way reconnect the sweetness of an apple to the sweetness of an idea? On the one hand, no, but on the other hand, yes, because the reason we're using the same term sweet is because it gives that same pleasurable feeling as sweetness. It's just on a whole different realm of experience. This is experience in a physical state, this is experience in an emotional state, and this is experience in an intellectual state. So you have that very same thing exist. The Rebbe says one thing. Let's understand something. All these experiences of the sweetness of an apple, the sweetness of a song, and the sweetness of an idea, of an end, these are all sweetness within our physical world of Asiya. Because even our minds, as we conceive ideas, they're all ideas as they are what? Channeled, or as we experience them in the world of, in the physical reality that we're in. So it's also physical. Within the physical, you see themselves within the physical experience. There is grubba physical, coarse physical, and then there is a more elegant physical experience, and there's even a more elegant. You see so many levels how the very same thing can exist in many realms. Now can you imagine what sweetness means in Olam Asiya HaRuchni, in the spiritual world of Asiya? We live in the physical world of Asiya. What does sweetness mean there? What does sweetness mean in Olam HaYetzirah, in the world of Yetzirah? There's also apple, and there's also the sweet apple. There is the sourness of the lemon. Every aspect, they all exist in those worlds, but over there we understand how completely beyond us that sweetness is. We have no push, we have no sense, in any way that we can even describe it, because we don't know what that world is all about. How does an angel experience sweetness? What does it mean, a sweet apple for an angel? That's not an apple, it's whatever it means. But an angel also has the experience of sweetness. Because if angels wouldn't have sweetness, we couldn't have it down here. Because all experiences, all human experience, are channeled from a higher world. So on the one hand, we realize it's on the same realm of experience, but so different, it's in a whole different arena. And then, can you imagine sweetness in the world of real? Sweetness is one example. Let's use another example. Let's say light and darkness. So there is physical darkness. And we say it's light as dark. Then there is sometimes we say, I'm so confused, I'm in the dark. And puts them in the dark. So it's the same new word we're using. I'm in the dark. But it doesn't mean you're in physical darkness. What does it mean? It means you're in spiritual darkness. What? Why? Because what's the idea of light? Light means clarity. So there is clarity when the lights are on. When it's dark, you can't see. There's no clarity. So I don't see what's a table and what's a chair and where there is a. So things aren't clear. And when it's light, the physical reality becomes clear. So when I'm confused and I have doubt, then what? Then it's blurry. Spiritually it's blurry. Psychologically I'm in the blur. When things clear up, when I can speak to someone who can clarify things for me, so then now it's mystic. The word mystic, it became luminous. So there's also light. So, and really, that's in our world. We understand that light can exist on higher realms of light, and even higher, and even higher, and even higher. The same that Eber says is also in wisdom. There is wisdom the way we know it here. The experience of intellect, of chachma, as it is in Olam HaSiyah HaRuchni, not even way above, we have absolutely no understanding of what wisdom means in the world of the spiritual world of Asiya. And even higher than that, the world of Yetzirah, forget about. The world of Bria is not, we don't even attempt in any way to understand what the soul's experience when we speak about intellect in the world. And ultimately, where do all experiences come from? Come from Hashem. So where does the sweetness of the apple really originate? Where does the sweetness of the apple or the sourness of the lemon, where do they originally come from? It comes from, the sweetness of the apple comes from Chesed, from the divine attribute of Chesed, and the sourness of the lemon comes from the divine attribute of Gevurah. That's its original source. The sweetness and sour comes from Chesed and Gevurah. So that goes all the way, or sharpness, it goes all the way back to its source. We understand that what? That we're just using the same word, even though it means something completely different. But before we continue, I just want to add one thing. As long as we're dealing with the realms of Asiya, our physical world, Yetzira, and Bria, even though we have no sensor to sense what the sweetness of as it is in the world of the Yetzira, or the sensor to sense, but we can at least imagine that even though we can't sense it, that there are higher kinds of beings that have spiritual sensors, and they're able to sense a sweetness that isn't physical. So we have some imagination of it. When we come to Atzilus, over there we're dealing with a whole different realm of existence, because over there we're dealing with infinite wisdom, infinite sweetness. It's not something that is, it's not mitzvah, it's not grasped in any kelim. So the experience of wisdom, the experience of chesed, the experience of love, all those things over there are radically different. There we can't even say, you know, I don't know what it is, but I have some inkling that it must be something like this. Or on some, there we can't even say the tiniest imagination or even in the most vague to relate to that, because over there it's not, it's on a level that is completely limitless. And there's no kelim, there's no sensor. Nothing senses it. Because it's not contained in any vessel. Even though we speak of kelim, that those kelim are infinite. It's not really considered a kelim. So it's pure love, no container for the love. Pure wisdom, no container, infinite. So that, so it's not just more quantitatively, more or quantitatively deeper. It's the jump from Berea to the world of Atzilus is an absolute jump. From Berea to Yetzirah, it all evolves. One thing evolves from the other. Because they're also creations. They're not lowly, coarse creations. They're spiritual, abstract creations. But nevertheless, they're creations. And they have parameters and limitations. So they have far broader parameters, far broader limitations. But nevertheless, they're still contained. So this evolves from this, and this evolves from this. But here we're dealing with a quantum leap. Something. The only thing we can say, and that's why we say about Achilles, we say, Chachma of Bria is called Chachma Yediyah. It's known, even though we don't know it. But we know that it's in some way related to the way we have it, but in a far loftier way. So we can give it a term, Chachma Yediyah. We can call Chesed, this weakness, we can call it Chesed Yediyah. It is in some way, we have some sense of what it is. But once we're dealing with Chesed of Achilles, we're dealing with the divine emotions and the divine intellect, over there we say, Loi b'chachma yediyah. There we don't, it's on a whole different scale. And if it's Loi, it's not yediyah. But nevertheless, from the attribute of Chachma, through a process of Yesh Me'ayin, as we're going to see soon, will evolve out the Chachma of Bria. And ultimately it will evolve human wisdom. Ultimately it will come down. That's why, what? It's called a makoyer for Chachma. It's a source for Chachma. It's not in it by itself. More than he doesn't even call it a source. Later he's going to call it a source for the source. The source, Bria, is called the source of Alecha. This is not a source. This is a source of a source. Because ultimately it will trace itself back to that experience, even though over there it's on a whole complete different realm of being. Let's read it inside. The sages tell us, higher and higher, meaning, the physical apple has a sweetness. And the palate tastes food. Are we going to say that there isn't the power of vegetation that is in the earth? But it has a taste and it has a sweetness. And for sure, b'mazel, and that in the mazel, in the spiritual mazel, it's not at all in any way, doesn't have any relationship to this type of an experience. Allah, what is the idea? That mesikas, sweetness, stems from kindness. And bitterness, migvura, stems from gevura. These are spiritual entities. Rak only that in the progression and in the order of the evolvement of levels, where things progress, madrega, level after level, nizgashmu, they coarsened, action nimshach mepchinas chesed nesikas, till after myriads of descends from kindness, which kindness is goodness, openness, revelation, comes sweetness. Sweetness is which brings pleasure. It evolves. It will ultimately develop when it will enter the realm of the physical world. In hayoyis, even though she'ein hayoyich elov, it absolutely, there is no erech, there's no value, there's no relationship at all. Memkomakam, nevertheless, whom the nizgoy utchinasay, it contains within itself that same chemistry, that same tchuna, the same word, the same character. Like we find, many types of sweetness in spiritual things. Tamoi is an example. The pleasure that one gets, that one delights in when you got a new insight. It also comes in a form of a sweetness. The same is also a pleasure, the delight of a song. That comes from a voice that emanates from the heart. That's an emotional sweetness. And therefore, become what you need is vishtalshulus. Through many, to a chain like progression of down and down and down as it's descending, nasa mesikas gashmi. Ultimately, it will evolve in a physical sweetness. Nasa mesikas gashmi mamash. It will become literally a physical sweetness. Hagam, even though shahefrish vahefko rav vineya, that the distinction and the differentiation is very, very great. And the same is the idea in the level of Chachma. In wisdom it's also, there's higher and higher. Hagam shechachma debriya eina me'erech v'loi mehus ha'chachma ha'niris v'niglis basiyo. Even though Chachma of the world of Bria, which is the first place where it's called Chachma Yediyah, it's called already a known Chachma, that too is light years away from the Chachma as we experience down here. Makal makar, nevertheless, who makar v'shoyrish liyas memenu ishavas b'chinas Chachma dasiyah ha'niglis. It is a source and a root that from it, through a progress of evolving, it will ultimately result in the Chachma of Asiya Haniglas, and the Chachma of the revealed world of Asiya. So even though we understand the great distance, but it will evolve. Now he's taking it further. And in truth, he says, it's not only Chachma D'Briya, it really, really originates already in Atzilus. Bekachi Chachma D'Atzilus. The same is already also Chachma D'Atzilus. Im me'yoyshihi b'chakim b'loy b'chachma Yediyah. The Rebbe is emphasizing. This is not just another level. Over here we're dealing already with some, and once we're coming to the realm of Atzilus, where we're dealing with the way all these things exist in God, so over here the leap, the distance, is far greater than the distance between one world and the next world and the lower worlds and the worlds of creation. Because they're all relative, they're all limited distance. Here we're dealing with real infinite distance, an infinite gap. Nevertheless, even though we say about it that's below the Chachma Yediyah, it is not with the known wisdom, Makom Makom, nevertheless, he uses the words over here, Ubchenis Makr Demakr. It is a source for a source. We can't call it a source, because it's not a Chachma Yediyah yet. It's not a known wisdom. It doesn't have a keli. It's not grasped in any vessel. No vessel. As great as the vessel should be, it will never be grasped. Nevertheless, it's the Avo. However, here the Rebbe says, now there's... So we understand, what did he do? He just now explained how awesome the spheres are. That they're so sublime, and we shouldn't in any way, when we speak about these things, relate to them in any way that the way they are in us. To understand how this... With notwithstanding all of this, he says, even that chachma that is lo b'chachma yediyah, that we call it, it's an undefinable wisdom, to God, and we say it's so abstract, so lofty, so distant from us, nevertheless, compared to the Ein Sof, compared to the Ein Sof that is extremely low and definitive compared to the Ein Sof. And more than that, the distance, let's put it this way, the distance from a physical rock to the wisdom of Atzilus. He would talk about the greatest distance possible. The taking the most inferior creature possible, a stone that exists within our physical world, and we're comparing it up in our world. If we can look for the things that are the most farthest away from each other, we would say the human intellect, a brilliant idea from a grain of salt. The distance of these two things is immeasurably. How far is the mind? Now let's take the lowest creature, a grain of sand, and compare it to what? To Chachma of Atzilus. Chachma is the highest attribute of the world of Atzilus, where all wisdom stems from, and it went through all these levels of Yetzirah, Bria. And these are only, we generally speak about four worlds, but really there's myriads of levels in each world itself. As it goes higher and higher and higher and higher and endlessly, till we'll get to the original source. We can imagine that the distance between our sand and Chachma Batsimus is immeasurable. Nevertheless, we say that what? The distance from the Ein Sof to Chachma of Batsimus is infinitely greater than that distance. Because the Ein Sof, far from God Himself, the distance of Him to His very attributes is much greater than the distance between Chachma Batzilus and a stone. Why? Because ultimately, the parameters and the definitions of creation originate in these parameters in Chachma Batzilus. That's already the source of some definition, of some little minute definition, a very vague definition, but nevertheless a definition. So there is some resemblance, because after trillions and unbelievable amounts of contractions and diminishing of that life, we will end up with physical matter. But the distance between the Ein Sof and Chachma Atzilus over there, from the level that is already characterized with some character, to the level that is totally beyond character, is endless. Endless. And that's the tremendous thing that we're saying, that despite the fact that it's so distant and so far, God lowers Himself down to define Himself in those definitions. It would be sort of to say, like, if you can contract yourself to be a stone, and that's you, not just much more than that, but that's... The person can define himself by being something that The tach, avo. However, lihiyoyf amtu chakim, for Hashem to be considered chakim, tahayim. Hamshachas oirin seif b'chachma, for the ein souls to be drawn into chachma, hinei ha-chachma mamish me'ayin timotze. The chachma is considered me'ayin timotze, yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. Which means, let's put it this way. Chachma in this world, the intellect that we have in this world, even though what we went and we explained how distant it is from Chachma of Bria, let alone Chachma of Atzilus, that is, it's not considered a defined Chachma in any way. It's not really called the Yesh Me'ayim, something from nothing. Because you can trace it back. Ultimately, our wisdom comes from the wisdom of angels. Wisdom of angels comes from the wisdom of higher angels. Their wisdom comes from higher angels. All the way, until it comes to the wisdom of God. Even though there is no resemblance, but still you can trace it. So the germ of it is already there, the nucleus of it exists already. So you can't really say that it's truly Yesh Me'ayim. Even though last week we spoke that between each world there is already a concept of Yesh Me'ayim. That's relative. But in the true sense of the world, something from nothing, this is not real Yesh Me'ayim. However, when we're taking the leap from Chachma to what is beyond Chachma, from Atzilus to Keser, from Atzilus to Ein Sof, that leap, if we're dealing with total newness, Chachma is already something new, because in God Himself, there is no definition whatsoever. You can't trace this Chachma back and say, oi, here in Hashem it's there. No, it isn't. Even though it comes from Him, of course. But it's not there in any way. Even in the most subtlest way, it's not there. It's like a creation. It's something totally new. Yesh Me'ayim, that's the point. Avol. Because it's mamish me'ayin timot. L'cheinu b'chines an v'senusa. That's why we're dealing with the ultimate of humility. Shehi yirid b'gedaylu l'fan of Yisbarach. This is a tremendous descent. V'zehu lashen atzilus. And the Alter Rebbe says, this is all implicate in the word atzilus. That's what the word atzilus implies. When we speak about atzilus, and we say how atzilus is so high, to the point that we speak about atzilus, we're talking about it like if it was something that is... The Alter Rebbe, it says it was in Ayin Yom. I think it's in one of the days of Ayin Yom. We say in Ayin Yom that the Alter Rebbe couldn't even utter the word Atzilus, because he would start, he would say Atzil, and he couldn't finish the word because of the tremendous fear that he had of saying that word because of the awesomeness of these attributes. And when speaking about this, so he couldn't even say it because to him it was something that it wasn't just words. It was something that he sensed and related to and to. So he couldn't even say that. Nevertheless, right, Atzilus itself is a tremendous descent. And that's what the word Atzilus means. Where does the word Atzilus come from? Atzilus means something that is separated from you. Not you, it's separated from you. Example, it says by Moshe Rabbeinu. When Moshe Rabbeinu, when the people complained that they wanted meat, so it says that Moshe said, my ayin li basar. How can I give them meat? Moshe said to God, where do I have meat? I don't have meat. Where am I going to get meat? Simply, it seems that Moshe says, where am I going to find so much meat in the middle of the Arabian desert over here? Where am I going to get so much meat? Kosher meat, no. Where is he going to find it? Hashem says to Moshe, okay, call the 70s. The Canaan. The Hasidic interpretation, Moshe didn't say, just where can I get meat? Moshe was saying that Moshe was the source of nourishment for the Jewish people. He provided them with everything. Of course, Hashem, through Moshe, Hashem channeled everything, and Moshe was the one who was the caretaker, the shepherd, gave them all their needs. Particularly, mainly, Moshe was transmitting to them their spiritual needs. But being that he was also, the Jews are not just spiritual souls, they're also physical entities. So Moshe, being their Rebbe and their king and their leader and their melech, had to provide for them their physical needs too. So he was the one. We know everything came through Moshe. Moshe brought the man down, right? And he knocked on the, and hit the rock, and the water came, and all these things. So Moshe was saying to God, really, I need to teach them Torah. That's what I am all about. My, what I am is really Torah. That's what I emanate to the Jewish people. However, I need to feed them too. So Moshe was able to lower himself down to some physical state. But even when he lowers up the physical state, the lowest physical thing he was able to create was man. Man was hardly physical. It was a spiritual energy that took on a subtle physical appearance just to so that you could put it in your mouth. The moment you put it into your mouth, it evaporated back into a spiritual thing. It was the most transparent, transcendental. I mean, it hardly was physical. And that's why the Jews didn't feel satisfied. The physical element, the body didn't feel satisfied, because you couldn't sink your teeth into it. It was too refined. So Moshe said, I can come down, I need to feed them. This is what he can bring them. Water is also a very refined thing. But to get grub, to get the meat, how can I give meat? Meat was too low for Moshe to be able to give meat. What does Hashem say to Moshe? Gather together the 70 people, and then I will take of your spirit that's upon you, and I will put it on them. I will separate from your spirit, I will put it on them, and then you will be able to provide meat. Why? God said to Moshe, I know you're really higher than meat, so we have to find a mediator. We have to find an intermediary, a middle stage. People that are what? On the one hand, they're spiritual. That's why they can serve as what? As a channel for you to the people. But on the other hand, they're not as spiritual as you, and they can relate to the people. So they can take your energy and process it and bring it down that it should be able to be processed as meat. Right? So it says, Vatfalti min aruach. So what does that mean? When they gave meat, it wasn't that the Zakenim were giving meat. The Zakenim don't have the power, couldn't give meat. It was Moshe that gave the meat. Even Moshe wasn't the real giver of the meat. It was God that was giving to Moshe, but through Moshe was giving to the men. It was Moshe giving, but how is Moshe giving? How is Moshe giving the meat? Through first, Moshe merged his spirit with the Zakenim. Once he merged his spirit, meaning he lowered himself down to be on the level of the Zakenim. Then through them, Moshe was giving me. They were like the instruments through which he was giving the meat. So what do we have over here? On the one hand, we have the spirit of Moshe, because only the spirit of Moshe is the source of the Ashpa. He is the Rebbe. From him the Ashpa has to come. From him the energy has to come. But it's too lofty. So it goes into them. That's the idea, he says, of Akshilus. Akshilus means to take, it's the aim, as he said before, the Ein Sof, it's not that there is Chachma. It's the Ein Sof himself characterizing himself in Chachma. But it's lowering himself down. So by Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, you have to lower yourself down to the, merge your spirit with a far lower spirit. Through this you can relate to the people. So let's read it inside. Yes.
Once,
the inner life, yes.
After that, why did there be a difference
and what?
And grain of salt.
Why? Because
once you got the food there, $1,000.
So you're saying the Etzem, the Abishta could have merged with a grain of salt too. He could have. And he really did, because and when Mashiach comes, every grain of salt or every grain of thing will taka be in the same level of Atzilus. Because Hashem taka makes no difference. If he can emerge with that, he can emerge with that, and then it's taka going to be that way. So the only difference is that really these things sense themselves as Nisradim. And it'll be a year, and Atzilus senses itself Miyuchid. And when Mashiach comes to the refinement of Tehran, it's just even the most external things will also see themselves as merely expressions of Him. And they're going to be. Because it is Miyuchid. Because it is so able, so it merges with Him to the point. Yeah, it is Miyuchid. That's the whole point he's saying. That it's totally Miyuchid with Him. Atzilus is Miyuchid. No, it feels like this because the angel is jumped into it. That's why it's miyuchad, not because before it could be. It didn't, in a grain of salt, he created a grain of salt. It should experience itself as another, as separate from him. Over here, it's like he created something and he became that creation. As opposed to other creations that he creates and they are not him, they're consequences of his energy, but they're not him. As opposed to here, it's like he creates something, but he becomes that. Vekach, let's read this side. Vekach, oh no, only over here. Vezeu lashon atzilus v'lashon hakodesh. Shehu lashon yerida v'ashpala. Atzilus is a lashon of descent. Mi madrigos v'hel yoyna, from that supernal level, la'ashpala satzmai, to lower himself, ki iluhu b'madrigit chusa. As if he is on a lower level. V'kamoi, for example, v'atzalpi min aruach. I will separate from your spirit, the Gaba Moshe, which says by Moshe. The Lafisha Amama Ayin Libasa, because he said what? Where do I have meat? Shahoisa Madrigasa Bimaila Al Yaina, his level was in a very high level. The Loy Haya Yachala Ashkula Saksma Bam Shachas Basar, because he was not able to lower himself down to that low state, to be able to draw flesh, Basha Gashmi, physical flesh. That's why Hashem said to him, Isfuli Shivamish, you gather for me 70 people. Shahem the Madrega Hapchusa, they're in a lower level. Hainu. Shaloyum is Gash Mimanish. Moshe can't relate directly to me, but he can relate to the 70 of Cana, because they're on a much higher level. They were closer to Moshe. So through Moshe could transmit to them. Ella, but here's the deal. Moshe still has to be in them. Moshe's spirit has to be in them. It can't be that they're giving. It never really left Moshe. When they were giving, it was Moshe in them that was giving, not them. They have to be real chassidim. They have to be totally bottled to their Rebbe. They couldn't be a thing. It was only that through them, you know, the Ella, rather, v'atzalti min aruach. It's your spirit. Similarly, you know, we always say that a shliach is really that idea. That, you know, a Rebbe has to remain in his quarters wherever he is, and he can't reach every Jew everywhere. And sometimes a Rebbe, in essence, of course, a Rebbe could speak the language of everybody, but sometimes the language of the person is better spoken by a person who is in that realm, who relates to the more to the physical realm. So how does a Rebbe transmits his energy to his chassidim, to his shluchim, and so forth? And the shliach is, it merges and it gets assimilated. It gets assimilated into the mind and the heart of the person. And that belittles it. That belittles it infinitely from the way it was when it was by a Rebbe. But then it's from their channel. What the shliach has to realize, that anything he's giving is not his own. It's a Rebbe speaking through him, and that's the idea. It was totally transformed, but it's still him. It's him in a completely different, on a much lower, in a lower state. So that's the idea of Atzilus. It's the Ein Sof, but the Ein Sof, as it's Vatalti, as it takes a plunge, it descends infinitely to a much lower stage. Ela Vatalti min haruach hashalecha v'samti aleim, I'll put in there. Piddish, meaning she'oided v'amshich, I will draw down and I will fall. P'chinas shalach. That your level, the p'china of yours, and that's why you're the one who can give the meat, because you're on that very high level. That part should materialize on a lower level, should metamorphosize into a lower being. The samti aleim, I will place it on them. They should derive from this level. But they, when these 70s came in, they did not, they got prophecy, some level of prophecy, but they were not elevated to the level of Moshe. And that's what he's explaining. The Esser spirits are not on the level of the Ein Sof. They remain where they are, Esser spirits. But Hashem descends to them. He descends to that place. O Kamoi Kain, and so too, Lamaila above, in Yin Atzilus, by the Atzilus, who p'chinas Yerida to descend, the Esser Slap Shesleid Ein Sof B'chachm. And the Ein Sof should close itself in Chachm. And that's why the 10 spheres of Atzilus are called Esser Tikkunim. They're called 10 ornaments. Shehem b'chinas levushin, they're only garments, because they're completely separate from him. Lo'oy rein soif. Lo'oy atzmias, they're not his essence. But at the very same time, they're called Tikkunim, not garments, not levushin. Why? Because he merges with them, just like the jewelry becomes part of the wearer of the jewelry. Nevertheless, ainon levushin mamish. They're not literal levushin, they're tikkunim. They're tikkunim mishim v'iyu v'garmi uchad, because he unifies with them. Ma she'en kein biya, which isn't the case in Briya Tzirashya, where he doesn't become one with them. They remain entities that are outside of him, creations of him. Kenisko Yael is mentioned above. Zehu, and this is what we mean, am tucha v'loy b'chushba. You are one, and not, you cannot be, you're not in the numeric oneness. You're totally beyond. What does that mean? Hashem, in its essence, utterly transcends the whole Yitzviris. He's completely beyond the cloud. the Koyi and the Alter Rebbe says, when it says that Hashem is Chad, he's beyond Eshetzius, in the Hagol, in this little parenthesis, he says, of course we're not even talking about God himself. But that we wouldn't even have to say that he is not in the Eshetzius, because that goes without thinking that he's not confined and limited, he's not a composite from various different spheres. When we're saying you are beyond, it means he's referring to the level of Keser. The Ein Sof, as it is in Keser. That, over there we say Am Tuchat. Beyond that, there's nothing to talk about it. We don't even have, that Keser we might have thought, that's the crown of Atzilus. It's in some way, we might think that it has some resemblance to the Esser Spheres. So he says, no, Keser Elyon is completely beyond. The Karl Keser Elyon, it's speaking of the Keser, Hamemutze, that is the intermediate, the mediator, Beina Matzel, between God himself, Linat Solon, to the emanation, from the emanator to the emanation. Even Keser is on a level that is utterly transcend, to the point that Chachma from him, from Keser to Chachma, is a bigger leap than from Chachma to a physical stone. The biggest Yeshmeyayim that there is from Keser to Chachma. Even though we usually go Keser Chachma Bina, as if it's one thing. Not at all. From Keser. She'ein eroich el of cloud. There is absolutely no erech, no value. Ki yesav is Chachma maha Keser. Because the Chachma to come into being from Keser, who may I in Mamish, is literally from nothing. Because you can't trace it in any way. The loy to say the Rishtalshalus, and not in the order of evolving, where one thing evolves from the other. She'en b'chinas esavus yesh meyesh. Because there it's a coming into being something from something. And now the Alter Rebbe is going to say like this. Really, the Rebbe says, there is really a concept of Keser between every world. Between Atzilus and Bria, there's also a concept of Keser. Which means there is a break of Yesh Me'arim, even from Atzilus to Bria. And from Bria to Yetzira, there is also a certain break, where we call the Yetzira Yesh Me'arim. And from Yetzira to Asiya, there's also a Yesh Me'arim. Meaning it's not just evolving, something evolved. It's, we're dealing with a whole new world. Nevertheless, over here, the next piece is going to explain the tremendous difference between the Keser that there is between worlds, one world and the next, and the leap, and the Keser of Atzilus. The real meaning of Keser is really only in Atzilus. Because over there, the relationship is, from higher to lower, is a real quantum leap. From level to level, on the one hand, it's Yesh Me'ayin, we can generally refer to it as something new. But on the other hand, it's not real Yesh Me'ayin, because there is some resemblance. We're dealing already in a progression of things that are already within the world of limitation, further limiting it. Even though they, once you enter a new world, it's unrecognizable, it's drastically different. So it's Yesh Me'ayin, but it's not Yesh Me'ayin on the same level as Keseta, as he explained. And here he's going to explain the idea. It's an amazing. Last week we were learning the idea of Parsha. The whole Maimon we learned last week was all about the idea of the Parsois, that between world and world there is this partition, the Parochas, the partition. And we're explaining how, what the partition is, and over there, we couldn't imagine that there should be a greater break than a partition. A partition was something that breaks the light completely, and it's a new thing. Here the Rebbe says, partitions, yeah, partitions are only a little break. A real break, a real radical change comes from what we call Tzimtzum. And he's going to explain the difference between Tzimtzum and Parsa. And many times we say, when we want to break away from one realm to another realm, we speak about the light coming through. We say that the light of God emanates, and then it evolves from level to level, and then it comes to a curtain. It comes to something that blocks. But then we say that what? The light passes through the curtain, passes through the screen, and continues on. And then it evolves again. Then it hits another screen. It completely transwaps it. Somehow the light permeates or bursts through the screen, continues on, but it's at a whole different level, evolves again from level to level. Again, we have a screen. That's the idea of a parsha. Sometimes we say that, and sometimes we say that, well, that in order for this level to come into being, God had to totally contract himself. He made a tzimtzum contraction. And if you look in Tanya, you'll find so many times that the Alter Rebbe explains the idea of God's light contracting. He says, it has gone through so many tzimtzumim and concealments. Yeah. Sometimes he uses parsois. So generally, say the same thing, he concealed the light. But here the Rebbe is going to illuminate the difference when we use tzimtzum and parsois. Because tzimtzum is a much greater concealment than parsois. And therefore the tzimtzum affects the light, the energy that's going to pass, if anything passes, on a much greater scale than the... And in general, it's going to explain it like this. Between the world of Ein Sof, between Keter and Atzilus, that's when we have tzimtzum. Tzimtzum means complete removal of a light. He calls it makom panoi, an empty space. A complete removal of a light. And when we deal with from Atzilus to Bria, and from Bria to Yetzirah, he doesn't say... he says it's parse. It's a transformation. It's a transformer, but not on the same scale. There's no point really of emptiness. Let's read inside, and then we'll understand it. We'll understand it in a minute. Vehine b'chol la'olam is in all worlds. Abia atzilus b'yitzira siri yesh b'chinas keser hamamutzim. There is an intermediary called keser. Ki malchus atzilus, because the level of malchus of atzilus nasa keser labria becomes the crown of the world of bria. The malchus the bria keser liyitzira, and the it's always the lowest level of one world becomes the crown for the next world. And the malchus of the Bria becomes the keser, the crown for the world of formation. However, difference between the keser of Atzilus to the keser in all the other worlds, if kiyasav is Atzilus, because the coming about of Atzilus from higher, who are yedei tzimtzum or ein sof, is through the contraction of the ein sof. What does contraction mean? Liyos makom panoi. That there should be an empty space, the cholol mamish, and a void. The shabbos bia, hainu al yidei paras, the bria from atzilus or yetzira from bria, and asiyah from is only through a partition. It's through a paras. Al yidei paras the hamafsik ben atzilus bria. It's through a partition, through a screen. Ube bria li yetzira between bria and yetzira. The loy makam panoi, and it's not empty space. What is the difference between a parsa and a makampani and a tzimtzum and a contraction that's called empty space? Let's talk a little bit just physically. When you have a light shining, and the light is very intense. For example, let's just explain for a moment what parsa. What is parsa? There is daylight, the sun shining outside, very powerful light. And there is the very same light that's outside that comes into a house. Generally, as it comes through into the house, it's diminished. Never as bright in the house as it is outside. But if it's a house with a lot of windows and a lot of light is coming in the day, it's the same kind of quality of light. If you have clean windows, it's the same quality of light. It's just that what? Less, because you're not directly under the sun. Sometimes in a darker room, because there isn't a lot of windows. But whatever light comes in, qualitatively it's less, but in quantity, quantitatively it's less, but qualitatively it's the same quality of light, the same light. If you're standing directly by the window, you're in that, the light is coming through. And if it's through a tiny little hole, it's also the same light. But then there is something called, you place a curtain. Or you tint the windows, tinted windows, something like that. So even if you have tinted windows, light will come through. But here, being that it's coming through a tint, or it's coming through a curtain, it's already a different light. Because the light, as we spoke last week, it's already a reflection of the original light. The original light almost like ends in the curtain. And then what goes through is like an offshoot. It's like the quality of the light changes. So it's called an urshel to a new light. So here you have daylight as it is. Yes, maybe in a diminished form, but it's still the same light. Once you're placing these curtains, you're blocking it, you're changing it. So he says, this is what is the difference between, for example, we say in the world of Atzilus, in the world of Atzilus, the Ein Sof shines. The Ein Sof radiates and shines in the world of the world of Atzilus. But how does the Ein Sof shine in the world of Atzilus? It says that in Chachma, it's coming through a door, in Bina, through a window, in Zod, through a little window, whatever, and in Malchus, it comes through a little hole, a neket, a hole. In essence, it's the same light. It's just, but when it's coming to the world of Bria, over there is already a parson. What's the parson? A parson means that as the energy already evolves into the worlds of creation, what takes place? Can't be the same light. for the same light would be too overwhelming, too powerful to creation. So that energy has to take on a whole new form and becomes changed. Right? Let's find a mashal for parsha, an example parsha in a less tangible way. We use physical light, but in order to understand what we're going to learn, it requires a little bit of an abstract mashal. What is the idea? We have like this. And we mentioned this mashal last week. This is the mashal of the mashal. The analogy of the analogy. Exactly that, the idea of an analogy. A teacher can teach the students. A teacher is a very brilliant teacher. He has a great mind. He has a great idea. So he sits down with the students and he teaches the students. So the students get the idea. Now the teacher is being that he's higher than the student. He knows that he has to limit the idea. Because to shower the student the idea with the full brilliance as the teacher understands it, it's just going to overwhelm the student. So what does the teacher have to do? Minimize it. Lessen it. But basically, if the teacher and the students are sort of within the same frequency, and the teacher has to minimize the idea, it's called like shine it through a window. For some students, the window isn't good enough. You have to shine through a little crack. And for some, it's not enough. You have to go through a tiny little hole. But the quality of the light is still the same light. The teacher takes the same idea. He takes pure wisdom. He's transmitting it to the students. But then there is Waf, where you have a great teacher, and you have students that are just immature, and they're not, they just, meaning intellectually immature, and they're not, the world of the teacher, they live in a whole different world. The teacher lives in abstract world of concepts, and the students live in Waf, in worlds of tangible reality. But what does the teacher have to do? The only way the teacher can give the concept is by giving a tangible example. So the teacher has to take this pure abstract thought and put it into a story. And make up a story. I teach fourth graders. So I'm always busy in the way I teach. I teach Pashas Mishpatim. It's a difficult halachos. It's very, hard, difficult concept. And it's interesting. You would think certain things other teachers would say, now forget about it. There's no way you can teach this to kids. They just don't have the sublimity of the mind to be able to receive those concepts. What I've always done is, every single halacha, Parshas Mishpatim, is put into a funny story, usually a story. So first of all, it's a funny story so they listen. Secondly, they get the most refined concepts. Why? Because in the story they can get it. Why can they get it? Because we're not dealing with a concept that, someone who wants to extract money from someone else and has to bring proof. The proof lies on the one that's extracted, the one that's taking it out. A kid doesn't know what he means. One thing else, the concept is too abstract for the child. It's a story. He knows what a person is. He knows what a dog is, what a cat is. He knows what a chair is. He knows what a bicycle is. So if you put the story into something, then they understand. Okay? Now, but here's the thing. When the child gets the idea after the story, they get the idea, but the idea is already, it's already in a whole different form. It was put into stuff. So it has taken on a whole new realm of existence because it's coming through a mashal. It's a mashal. That concept, that idea is called a parsa. Parsa means you're putting it through something that is not the idea. It's not the intellectual idea as it is. You're putting it into things that are alien. It's only that these things you're enclosing in it an idea so that the child can grasp, and now he gets the idea. But it's already, it's not just minimizing it, it's giving it a whole new flavor, putting it into a whole new realm of existence. That's the idea of shining through a curtain. The idea as it is in the mind of the teacher stops, and now it's passing through and going through a curtain. But this is not called the Yeshmei. Last week we learned that it is called the Yeshmei. That's why it's so difficult now to undo everything just last week, because he's explaining the other extreme now. On the one hand, we say it's Yeshmei. Why? Because the idea as it is presented now is totally new, because it's put into physical terms as opposed to its original way. But it's not the Yishmiyayim, because after all, where does this idea come from? It comes from that abstract idea. It's really all there in that original source. Over there it was just abstract, and here it took on a certain tangibility. However, there is what we call tzimtzum. What does tzimtzum mean? Tzimtzum means a total retraction of the light. Meaning the teacher studies, the teacher talks to the student, and the mind of the teacher is so beyond the mind of the student that even a muscle, even an example won't hurt. You can't do that. The only thing the teacher can do is just teach the student something else, because this concept just cannot be transmitted to the student. Let me give an example, but then the teacher's not teaching. That's not called teaching. It's just holding it back. We have to find an example where you're giving something, but you're giving it through what? Through not giving. Through totally concealing. How do we have something like that? Let's find here's a good analogy for something like that. When the teacher and the student are so distant from each other, an example we can find is sort of like this. The difference between a person who can see and a person who's blind. There is a teacher who not only does he study, not only does he understand, and he has a brilliant mind, but his way of thinking is that when he learns something, he actually sees it. Doesn't see it physically, but he can actually see the concepts. He sees them. There's such clarity, crystal clear. He sees it in his mind. Then there are students. The student can't see. The student can't feel it. The only thing the student can relate to is understanding. Describe it to me. You can describe the idea, you can't see it. Let's give a physical example for something like that. You walk into a room, you see the room. You see the doorway, you see the windows, you see the chairs, you see the things. And a blind person is in the room. A blind person is looking, wants to get out of the room, but he can't see. What does the blind person do? Starts feeling, touching around, and then going around. He's going around. So finally he comes and he feels an open space. No, open space. I found the door. So what? So he goes and he starts walking. But he gets stuck. Where did he get stuck? Because it was a window. Why was it a window? Why did he know it's a window? Because he realized that the opening is only on the top. And the opening is not on the bottom. So that must be that what? There's a window. So he has proven himself. Good. So now he continues. He's not giving up. He continues looking for the door. So he's feeling and feeling his way around. And suddenly he finds again an opening. But this time he's smarter. He's not going to, he's not going to hurt himself by banging into the window, the bottom. He's going to make sure that it is a door. So what he does is, he bends down, and he feels that, right? He's feeling that the bottom should also be open. So now he goes, and he realizes the bottom is also open. So he starts walking. Then walking, and suddenly, smash! He bangs his head. And he walked into a pantry or something. Or one of those, a closet. He walked into a little closet. So now he realizes this. So finally, after all demonstration, he comes to the conclusion. He feels around and he finds a door. Now both people know that what? Where the door is now. The blind person knows where the door is now. And the one who can see knows where the door is. But we're dealing with a whole different type of a knowledge. He knows, not because he knows. He knows, but how does he know? For him, it's proof. He made a proof, right? That what? By proving that what? By feeling around and reducing. This must be the window. This must be the closet. This must be the door. He has all kinds of intellectual proofs what the room looks like. And that's his reality in the room. He understands that the degree of knowledge that he has is extremely limited to what he's able to feel. Of course, definitely there's no color, there's no sight, there's nothing to it. But whatever it is, there's some recognition of the form and shape, because he used his mind to... The one who sees, sees. It's a whole different... The amount, in a sense, it's almost like you know it infinitely more than the other guy. The other guy only knows it to the degree that he's able to extrapolate it from what he feels. It's not this, it's not this, so it must be that. We're dealing with a whole different level of knowledge, and a whole different level of reality. It's sort of like, it says that this is the difference between the early scholars, the Rishonim, the early scholars, and the Acharonis. We look at the Rishonim, in the earliest writings of the Rashi, and the Tosfos, and the Rambam, whenever they wrote in the Torah, they wrote everything short and concise. Very short. You look at the books of the latter Acharonim, there's elaboration, and everything has a million proofs. It's questions and answers and proving from this Gemara and proving from this Gemara, much longer discourses or much longer answers from any question. So you think, wow, Achronim, they're far greater, they were much greater minds than the early ones, because they had nothing to say, only short. The explanation is given the exact opposite. The Rishonim, they were so brilliant, and they had, by them, when they looked at something in Torah, they right away saw it. So they didn't have to prove that this is the window and this is the door. Here it is, see, this is the door, this is the window. Everything they looked at a Gemara, they saw light. They understood it. So the Achronim didn't have that measure of illumination of that light. So how did the Achronim learn? It all works in a way of, this can't be the pshat. This can't be, you have to eliminate. This, it can't be this. We thought it might be this. No, this, it can't be this. It can't be that. So ultimately it must be this. But afterwards, even when you know, it's a whole different knowing. You don't know it like when you see it. And you see it. So what happens if you have a teacher who his way of study is that when he learns, he sees things. But he has a student, and the student can't see. So what does the teacher now have to do when he needs to teach? He wants to teach the student, not that he doesn't want to teach him, and he wants to teach him this very concept. But he can't use it. If he's going to come to the student and try to explain to the student what he sees, the student has no relationship to the other. It's like trying to speak to the blind man and trying to describe him colors and things. He can't. He doesn't relate to it. He can't. What does the teacher have to do? He has to completely remove from his conscious mind his image that he has of the thing, his vision that he sees it. That he has to completely retract. Now, what does it mean retract it? It doesn't mean that the teacher forgets about it or he eliminates it from his brain. He deletes it. What it means is he has to take it away from his conscious thinking and put it where? Put it up. He has to put it into his memory. Put it somewhere. Now he must approach the... Can you imagine if you would have to give a class to blind people? You say, reddish, it's this and it's that. You can't explain it based on what you've seen. The only thing you can do is you can use scientific terminology, if you can in any way, in giving some, using, you know what I'm saying, using various forms of proofs of how things can be. But that's so far, and the only way you can do that is if you take away your vision of it. Because if you remember, even in the inkling of how you're seeing it, it just won't go over. Examples won't help. That's what it means. You have to create an empty space. Being that we're dealing with a distance that is so far, the only way you can transmit from ear to ear is by completely hiding the idea. The idea has to... So as we were saying, from Atzilus to Bria is so apart that for the Ein Sof life to address the world of Bria, there has to be a complete what? Makom Pani, empty space. What's the difference between Makom Pani and a Parsha? In a Parsha, you're not hiding. You are transmitting. It's only that you're transmitting in a concealed manner. You're taking the idea. Let's say you're giving a muscle, you're giving an analogy. When you're coming into a little class where there's always speak about the fire engines. So you're never in a state of not teaching. You're teaching. You're in a constant state of yeah giving, positive giving. You're giving. It's only that you're concealing it, you're wrapping it up in wrappers that the students can fit. But there's never a moment of no, not giving. Of course, you stop a minute to think. But what you're doing is you're giving. When you're dealing with teaching as the matter that I spoke about before, because we can imagine a teacher and a student that are so distant, that this one sees it, and the other one he needs to find proofs for, over here there is a different type of concealment. A concealment of, no, I am not going to teach this. He has to take the idea and want, completely reabsorb that idea in his mind, take it out of his conscious mind, meaning he has to take it from its illuminated state, from its conscious state, hide it in his mind, then come up with a whole different method, a method from the bottom up, the method of extrapolation. I'm going to extrapolate like this, I'm going to bring proofs and whatever, that whole system, that way of thinking. So there is a certain point of, he is hiding something completely. That's the idea of a tzimtzum. Something completely being withdrawn, as opposed to makom parsha. Parsha, there is a constant giving, it's just, in parsha it's not that you're not there. You are there. The light is there. The light is only coming through a curtain. Something that's covering on it, but the light is coming. In tzimtzum, tzimtzum means a withdrawal, it's not coming. What is coming? What is coming is already not that. Something completely different, which as we said before, it's like the teacher who takes the very idea that he sees and has to explain it in a whole different realm of explanation. An explanation not in seeing it. That's the idea. What? Which is the empty space. Because the empty space is the teacher needing to say, you know what, if I will speak the language of my language, which I make, then there's no way I can give anything over to the student. So I need to totally remove that and start speaking on a complete different, term. Yes.
Would there be another analogy to the teacher?
Yes.
Of the kid's student and the teacher, rather than explaining to him, he wants to explain it to us.
True, but that's not what he's speaking about over here. He's talking about the original transmission of life. Now,
that was man.
No. The mission of life, where once it's going to come from the Ein Sof state, to the from the Belig Gvul, from beyond boundaries and borders, to the state of Gvul, there has to be a point where there's a total cutoff.
But he's creating boundaries.
He's creating boundaries, but that's already like a whole new, it's like the teacher saying, you know, what has been before has ended in my mind, and I'm now relating in a whole new realm of, that's called Makom Pan. So let's read it inside. Will be understood by first understanding the tzimtzum and the Ein Sof. The only thing is that in order he prefaces this by saying one thing. That what? In order to understand what the tzimtzum of the Or Ein Sof means, the contraction of the infinite light, we first have to know what the infinite light is. And that's just a little side talk of what the infinite light is, and then we can understand what the tzimtzum in the Ein Sof is. But we're not going to elaborate too long. Just go quickly. Ki oirin, so the infinite light, haino oir v'gilo liyos ezes fashtus v'shavus. Makar v'chayis. Oir ein sof means a light and a revelation, that there should be some expansive and bringing into being a source of energy for anything. I mean, the ein sof is the original power emanating from God, that he could his creative power, his infinite creative power flexing its muscles. In other words, that's the Ein Sof light. It's emerging out to be available for creation, to be available to be a source for anything. But it's like God. Revealing this potential. Now God's potential is endless. So that light, meaning there is a state where he's not revealing anything. Potential is, yeah, but we're dealing with our Ein Sof. The light, which is Ein Sof, means God's potential being expressed as what? It being expressed, but being that it's his potential, he has infinite potential. That's his Ein Sof. Now, from that Ein Sof light couldn't come any worlds. Why? Because God's infinite potential is infinite, and therefore the creations could not exist without. The creations were to be exposed to his infinite power, so then automatically what? They would be nullified, and they couldn't be finite, because his power just would stretch them endlessly. As you can say, you know, he's creating something and stretching it and making it and endlessly making it. So therefore, that's why, as long as the Ein Sof light, as long as there was an expression of Ein Sof, what? There could not be, as God's creative power was fully exercised and fully manifest, there could not be any worlds. Now, in the Ein Sof itself, he's saying, there is two levels of the Ein Sof. There is the Ein Sof light as it leaves God, Kiriyachol, whatever that means. And there is the Ein Sof where the light is still in him. For example, let's take sunlight. There is the sun. There is an example where the sunlight leaves the sun. And there is a state where the sunlight is still absorbed where? Within the sun. So, there is Ein Sof God's light where Hashem is allowing it outward to be off, meaning to say he's revealing his creative power. Hold on a minute. He's leading his gig. Then there is a state where we're dealing with that Ein Sof energy still contained within him. That we don't see it as a power of Ein Sof, but rather we see it as completely submerged in him. His capability to create infinitely. Because there is a level where that Ein Sof separates a little bit from him, that it's the creative energy itself, not him. You see the energy a little bit as a creative power. But there is still a state where that creative power is not a creative power, but it's God's creative power. So it's Oyer, because we're dealing with a creativity. It's an emanation of him, not him himself. His ability. But his ability, as it is seen, as it's still very, very much linked to him. It is a very subtle idea, which we're not going to now expand on. But the other saying that the tzimtzum took place, the contraction took place in the Ein Sof light, as it was still embedded in him. And not because after the tzimtzum, the Ein Sof is reintroduced, but there the Ein Sof is already seen sort of as a creative energy, not completely in him. Before the tzimtzum, let's not get into that now. The Hainu, or else we'll never get finished. The Zekoidim Shenivra Oilam, and this is what we mean, the Oiring says Shabbat Musoi, what does it mean? The infinite light that is still contained in him. I'm holding 1, 2, 3, yes. Hainu Pshinazu, this level, Sheyesh Boy Oir, that he has the capacity, the capability, Liyos Meir, or Mispashit Lahabis Lahabis. That God has the ability to illuminate endlessly, and to create and bring into existence. This is what it means. Before God created the world, He and His name were alone. What does it mean? He and His name were alone. Two things. I say that before God created the world, He and His name were alone. Of course, there was no world. There was no world. Yeah. Oh, what he's saying is, the name is what. His what? His capabilities. His power. And him is what? What's him? Him is the Ein Sof himself, God himself. There's him and there is his power. So what it's trying to say is that before God created the world, his power was not seen as something other than him. It was his power. It was completely embedded in him. So it was that's what we mean. Bilvad meaning that there wasn't two things. Who is Shmo? Him and his name. The name was completely in him. However, after he started creating the world, meaning after the first symptom, and the name separated, sort of to be an Ein Sof power detached from, separated from him at least, or not so clearly connected to him.
Creation?
It doesn't become a creation, but it becomes an entity. But we can look at it and say, wow, look at this creative power, not seeing it as God's creative power, but as a power unto itself. It's not important for the understanding of the general mind, so let's not get into that. Shmoy, who are in Sof Shabbat's Musay, and the name is Ein Sof that's still in him, Shurak Bechina Shmoy, which is only the name, Shurkhina Tagila. Why do we call it name? But just like name is just a revelation to others, so through the name in God means his power to reveal. His capability that he could reveal himself. Like the radiance of the sun, the radiance is the light. The sun also has that first and original state, that light of the sun that radiates outward. Where is it from? It's really the first and potentiality within the sun. The sun itself is the ma'ar. The light that emanates from the sun is called light. And he called the light day. Shahayon Nikra Oyer, that the day is called like that. Al Shem, meaning, because the light is flowing, it's not flowing, it's radiating. It's Pashtus Oyer Vahazi. Masha Meir Biyoyin, which is illuminating by day. Vashenkin Atzvis Hashem is Nikra Mo'er. He's saying like this, the sun itself is not called Oyer, the sun is called Mo'er. Mo'er, the illuminary, the illuminator, where the illumination comes from. Light, which means active, expansive light, is called light. So when God is also, Hashem himself is not called Oyer Ein Sof, he's called the Ein Sof, where it comes from. But God's power to illuminate, to shine forth, to create, that's called the Oyer that's in him. And that itself has two stages. There is a stage where that is in a more outward state, where you can sort of see it onto its own. And there is a state where it's still in him. Where did the Tzimtzum, let's not get into it. Where did it's not the point of the mind. Where did the Tzimtzum take place? The Tzimtzum took place where? In the or as it was still in him. Meaning, with Kamar Shekhar, we're going to get to that in a second. Hashneya ma'ir esagdaleh. Hakachu ba'ir ein soif. Sha'or nikra ha'gilui shem is passionate men. The or is called the light as it emanates from him. His havas or b'chai. The ein soif ba'atzmo hu b'chines ha'ma'or. And God himself is called the ma'or. Shu makar ori is the root of the light. U'memen enim shekhar. Hinei, let's continue on forward because this is always just mainly parenthetical. Hinei, ha'tzimtzum ha'yo ba'ir ein soif. The tzimtzum took place where in the ein soif. In the light of the Ein Sof. Meaning God, but he wants to emphasize like this. The Tzimtzum didn't take place in Hashem himself. God didn't change. He and the Ein Sof himself, the Tzimtzum took place that while. Said before, the Or Ein Sof is God's capability to create. That was contracted. Meaning God created only finite creations. So if he created only finite, just one of God's abilities do we see? Not as infinite power to create, because that was not exercised in creation, because then the creation would be infinite. And since the creations are sort of in defined and limitations, which means that infinite power to create was totally concealed. What was revealed of God was a whole different form of energy. So that's what it means that Tzimtzum was in the who-ha of God. Meaning, God, there is Him Himself, and there is the wow! The wow of God we don't see anymore. The awesomeness of his true might and power and endless, that was concealed. But the very beingness of God has not been concealed. The evidence is an amazing thing. That's why we don't know much of Hashem. That was concealed, shrouded in the process of creation. But there's one thing, he says, that everybody knows. Everybody's aware of God. That God exists. It's a very powerful thing. And little children have no problem with God. And as little children, automatically, God is, you tell them about God and they're, it's obvious to them. Simple people are doing no philosophically minds and so on. It's so obvious there's a God. Why? There's God in front of them. There was absolutely no symptom in the Ein Sof. The illuminary himself is everywhere visible in a sense. Visible meaning he's so dear. What was concealed? Not his very being, him, was not concealed. What was concealed is his qualities, his awesome abilities. If that would be revealed, then why his capabilities, then the world couldn't handle it as it is. So the world can only see God's capabilities in a very limited fashion. Limited and limited and limited. It's like, sort of like this. You have a brilliant man, a genius of geniuses, okay? So, people look at him. So there is a child. The child looks at him a lot. Doesn't have any grasp in the wisdom of this person. And you have a scholar who looks at this person and, ooh, he has already some appreciation of what? Of this person's genius. And you have a scholar, a professor, a great professor, he has even a greater appreciation of what? Of their genius. And then you have many, many multitudes of levels of how they appreciate the genius of this scholar. So you have, but you can have the most simplest or tiniest child standing next to this professor, and they're aware that what, there's a person here. The very being of this person is there, that they know. Even though they don't know anything about them, have no appreciation on the quality of the person, of what type of person is, but that very being, he knows that, that this person is there. He can see, which means the essence is there available for everybody. The very eye of that person. If Albert Einstein walked into it, the Vilna Goyen or some other genius of geniuses walked into a place. So everybody was there. Jew and non-Jew, Gentile, sees the person. Here he is, the guy with the white beard. The person with the white, the genius, right, he's here. Which means, and the truth is, the person is not his quality. The quality is the quality. You are, and we spoke about it earlier, you're not your special unity. And it's an amazing thing. The very essence of the person is accessible to everybody. What is not accessible to everybody is what? The revelations of this human being. The radiance that they radiate. Very few people could be recipients of the great genius of a genius like Einstein. But when we're dealing with the very person, a two-year-old and the highest professor see the same thing. They see the person. But he has an appreciation of this is not just an ordinary person. This is... And the more you understand his greatness, then you're more involved in the quality of it. And the child doesn't only know, just knows the fact that he exists. The same is with God. God's very busy. When a Jew, when you ask a Jew, how are you doing? He says, Baruch Hashem. Baruch. And that Baruch Hashem, he doesn't know anything. What Hashem is. He doesn't think. Why? But he's so sure that the fact that he's doing well is because Baruch Hashem, because God is. Without knowing anything. And it's interesting. The Baal Shem Tov says, and the Baruch Hashem from the simple Jew is really, and that Baruch Hashem is relating to the very, very essence of God. More than the highest, deepest discourse that we can learn in the mind. Because in the discourse that we're learning in the Maamar, what are we talking about? We're not talking about God's very being. We're talking about what? So, as I said before, his power, his greatness, and that's not him. But when a child says, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, when he says, Baruch, thank, or good night, God, Hashem, you know, I love you, that's you. That's him. And there you have Hashem in his full being. That's what he thinks. Ein Sof is everywhere. God never hid. He hid his creative power. That has to be it. The revelations of his qualities and so forth, that has been hid. So the first thing, but once he explains that the Ein Sof was hidden, he begins to explain the difference of that type of hiding and the hiding of the pious, which he's going to explain. But I think that maybe we should continue next week.